The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
It's All-Ireland Final Week. Anything to say, boys?
No, it's great to be here. It's great.
How would you stop?
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
So normally people are emigrating from Mayo, but in this case we've sent our uncle travelling Matt all the way to Mayo. I think Owen Sheehan is with us this morning. Good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Ger. How are things?
Yeah, very well. Better still. How are you?
Yeah, very well, actually. Mayo and Castlebar, that's where I am specifically, is quiet this morning. It is misty. There is a haze that has descended on the town as if some haunted event is about to occur. I can't possibly tell what that might be.
What has your reception been like?
Very good. The red carpet has been proverbially rolled out and almost literally, in a sense as well. Everybody here is absolutely delighted that they're in an All-Ireland final. Everybody here is delighted to speak about their excitement for an All-Ireland final. And people have literally welcomed me into their homes, have literally made me food, and have literally, I guess, given me a warm welcome into this fantastic county. So I don't understand if there was like an undertone to your question, Ger, but
well,
you've answered.
You've been very rude about the people of Mayo on several occasions down through the years, and I wondered if they had borne a grudge, if they were aware of the stuff that you've pulled on them.
Of course they're aware, and I've never been rude about the people of Mayo. There is a respect and an honesty there that goes both ways.
Right. How excited are they? How worried are they? Because the fear, surely, as each day the excitement increases, it's compounded by the other side of your shoulder being completely burdened by the fear that, oh no, this could all happen again.
I think that there is a real lack of burden on these supporters anyway. I think we'll know with the playing group come the weekend. I think we can take a pretty good guess that they're not really feeling the weight of history, but they are, when it comes to the fans, feeling this just amazing buzz of excitement. And I think there is this acceptance that this is truly a golden era for Mayo. It's hard to know how far into the lifespan of the golden era we are, but this week here has actually reminded me a little bit of what Kerry was like in the 2000s when people talk about All-Ireland finals as a course of habit. You know, what is your routine? What did you do last year, the time before COVID? What are you going to do this year? What's almost as if it's like a casual weekend away, an All-Ireland final. However, there is also a huge acceptance for how much of a privileged situation that is. And that's probably where it differs to maybe the Kerry fans of the 2000s. There is a real appreciation for how brilliant a situation this has been for this county, that they are consistently in the last two of the All-Ireland Football Championship. And I guess a real sense that it's going to happen eventually. Like, there is no need to constantly get carried away with the devastation of defeat when you can enjoy beautiful weeks like these, when everybody is talking about this one sporting event. Everybody is truly invested in what's going to happen in those 70 minutes on Saturday. And that's kind of a special thing for a full county to be truly invested in. And that's the thing you get about Mayo, is that, sure, it may not be like Limerick City, for example, where I was a few weeks ago, where there's just this volume of flags everywhere because there's just so many people. There's just less people in Mayo, but every single one of them cares deeply about the events of this weekend.
I know that Joe Biden has kind of ruined Seamus Heaney, but the Hope and History Rhyming Week, this is it for Mayo, right?
100%. 100%. This is where it all comes home. And like, of course, when the match previews come through all weekend, they're already on the show. You've been doing plenty, and the takeaway is that it is impossible to call. That can't not seep into the nerves of the supporters. But those nerves exist for the Tyrone fans. There is nothing uniquely Mayo about how nerve-wracking this final might be. This final is a nerve-wracking spectacle, and it will be for everybody, because these are two up-and-coming teams who didn't come from nowhere but came as relative outsider cities to this final. Both came as outsiders into the semi-finals and won. And neither of these two teams are going to do things that we fully expect in this final. So, yeah, the hope is there. And, of course, when the history rhymes with it, when Mayo eventually get over the line, I'm sure we'll look back in hindsight and say, oh, well, you know, this was a great final for Mayo to be in, as it turned out. But similarly, you will also find people who will say that actually this is a very tricky final. This is a very tricky week. and there is something of an unknown about what they're facing into on Saturday evening.
Okay, all right. It's 7:35 this morning. As you know, Owen is obviously in Mayo. He's been travelling around the country for the past couple of days and managed to chat to some of Mayo's most passionate supporters. Have a look at this.
As Mayo looked to finally end 70 years of hurt, we searched up and down the county to find someone who could tell us all about the hype. We ended up bumping into boxer and Mayo superfan Ray Moylett, which is pretty convenient given Mayo's fullback Padraig O'Hora is also a skilled combat sportsman.
Oh, he's that man, when you put his name into anything, it's going to be combat. You know, he's as tough as old boots. And, you know, I knew him from a few years ago. He used to box with Aidan Ray down there, or Bell now. I'm not even sure which one there was, when I was in Westport boxing. And he used to come up sparring and all that. But to my recollection now, we haven't sparred or anything like that. But when he was on that Ultimate Hell Week on RTE, that... the Rangers course, and I was sending him messages, you know, throughout that. Obviously it was pre-recorded, but I was following him, I was sending him messages, and he actually told me that I had to be no bother to me and that my boxing background, but I definitely beg to differ. But we actually ended up saying that we'd go sparring or we'd go doing a bit of training, because I know he's into MMA as well, and so that was definitely something he put out for a bit of a spar. But I'll actually call him out here now. So they win Sam Maguire, myself and himself will do an exhibition fight, and we might raise a bit of money for some charity. We'll let him decide the charity, but I'll put my name to that and put my name into the ring with him.
You won't do a push-up off instead?
No, I'm actually fed up of doing push-ups at the minute.
Shortly after speaking to Ray in Castlebar, we moved to this super-secret location, which definitely wasn't just the other side of the same park in the middle of Castlebar. We had secured a meeting with RF, who you may know from such things as the RF podcast and Twitter. You may also know him as an international man of mystery, and this interview was only granted on the strict promise of anonymity.
Yeah, I think there's a different edge to this Mayo team, and it's great. Look at, we said it already. We'll probably lose the run of ourselves, and we'll paint sheep, and we'll paint anything that we can, red or green, and we'll mow the lawn up Mayo and whatever else that goes with it. Like that part, you know, I say it in the tagline in the Twitter account. It's only a game, like, but it is. It's why? What's the point of sport if you can't enjoy it? You know, that's what it's for, and I think people forget that. A lot of people take it too serious. We lose a run of ourselves, enjoy it. That's what it's all about.
It's the whole point, really, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the whole point of it. Spectators. It's you go, you enjoy it, you enjoy the day out. These guys are obviously enjoying it in a different way by maxing out themselves in terms of their sporting ability and performing on a stage in front of the world. Like,
yeah,
you know, sometimes we find it hard to separate what's needed and what's here for enjoyment, and that's, you know, the way I see it anyway. So that's what it's all about.
Anyone who has listened to Tommy Tiernan's podcast will know that the man has no time whatsoever for the town of Ballina. So we went to Knockmore, home of the Mayo County Champions, and also in the general vicinity of Ballina, to chat to his podcast colleague, Loretta Blewett.
I think, you know, secretly he does like Ballina. I think because he really was not in good form the day we were there. He got hay fever, he was hungover, and I was, you know, protesting too much about how great a town Ballina was, so he was going the absolute opposite. But I've noticed now the last couple of weeks he's you know, trying to get back into Mayo favour again. Actually, you know what, the way it is, we're supposed to be recording on Monday, and if we're all Ireland champions, I'd say the boys are going to have to come down to Mayo. I refuse to go to Galway next week if we're recording up there, so maybe we get him down to Ballina again and maybe smooth things out. I'm sure they're a welcoming bunch, in fairness, so they'll probably take it on the chin.
No trip to Mayo is complete without a visit to the Las Vegas of Ireland.
Well, there's great excitement in Knock, looking forward to the All-Ireland final this year. Naturally, with our very talented Mayo team in it, we're wishing them all the best on Saturday, and hopefully they'll bring home Sam Maguire. We're 70 years waiting for him, so it would be a very welcome visitor to Mayo. The extra prayer and the extra bit of holy water for the Mayo team this year. Well, we haven't been there for the last few years, but yes, indeed, we always have a special devotion. People come and give an extra prayer for the winning of the Sam Maguire. Well, this year we have the Mayo flags going all over the world. We also have an online shop, so our Mayo flags are making its way to Australia. And people, visitors that come to the shrine, bring home a bit of water and a Mayo flag. Even to Tyrone, we had one of our customers there last week, and the Mayo flag won its way up to Tyrone as well, with Knock Holy Water, of course.
They say 1.5 million people visit Knock every year. It is the second most visited tourist attraction in the county of Mayo, trailing by some distance behind Mick Burns Bar in Castlebar. Here's the man himself.
With the help of God, we'll have Oisín Mullen back, and I'm quietly confident that Owen McLaughlin will play some part too as well on Saturday. I think we have the sixth best back in the country, and it'll be down to forward power and the whole lot, but I do think that we are the slight favourites, and rightly so.
A broken jaw won't keep any Mayo man out of the final.
A broken jaw never kept a Mayo man out of anything.
When I go into the ring, it's just, I know it's not only me, but I feel if I win, like all my friends are going back to work on Monday, but I'm out to celebrate and I'm the bad guy. But that's but like if a football team wins, the whole team is out on a Monday and they're great. So everything I do personally is nearly for myself. So to be involved, not involved, but to be part of something with Mayo football and the culture of it in Mayo, and it's the full community, it's for everyone behind them. And we're just all delighted to be part of it and to be back in an All-Ireland final. I think we're nearly disappointed if we don't get to the final, and we'd be very disappointed if we don't win it this year after beating the champions Dublin. You know, everyone thought Dublin couldn't be bet for the next 10 years, the way they were talking.
I think when we don't win, we haven't won in so long and we've been bet so many times, I think people enjoy the, you know, the journey, not the destination. I think that's probably why, maybe, you know, in a way, Mayo people probably enjoy the build-up a lot more and kind of lose the run themselves, because it's part of, you know, that is until the day of the game, you know, so there's no winners or losers up until that point. And it's in our psyche now to probably enjoy the build-up a lot more than because we don't know what it's like to win with.
My biggest problem at the moment, the reason I'm not going to the match, is that I've no staff. And, you know, with the restrictions, as I said earlier, I have to look after my locals. I have to make sure that they're, you know, that they're here on the day. And if I'm in Croke Park watching the match, I wouldn't feel comfortable. I've no emergency button, certainly not. But, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. I rang a friend of mine, who retired publican up the country, and he said he'd come down for a few days crack. But knowing him, it'll be crack with him and there'll be no work involved. But look, we'll win and we'll discuss the whole lot then after that, when we, you know, when we do win, Sam, with the help of God. This is the first one I missed, Jan. It's breaking my heart, to be honest with you. It's the first we owe, this year and last year was the first time in since 19 as far back as I can remember that I've missed a Mayo match. And it's just unfortunate with the circumstances that are in, the COVID being one, short staff being another, and, you know, business comes first. I mean, you know, we'll have plenty of time to celebrate, but not to be there will break my heart to see Aidan O'Shea lifting Sam on the day.
There's always a few people that'll keep it real, you know, and just say, oh, I was getting my nails done today, actually, and they were all talking in the nail bar about how everyone thinks we've won already. So, but I'm like, oh God, no, don't think like that. I think the further we go on and the longer we're in these situations, I think the more real we become. I think we can't get too carried away at this stage.
What is the temperature amongst the Mayo fans at the moment?
Spicy. mildly spicy. I know it's there's an excitement, but there's a seriousness to it.
Yeah.
There's a seriousness there I don't think I've ever experienced or felt with people. You know, no, you know, you ask the general public or you ask the guy in the street, yeah, I think that, you know, they have a chance, they have a good chance. You know, it's not I will go up and give it a go, you know, like what's been in years before. Or, you know, some people, you know, obviously there's going to be crackpots out there that think they're going to win by 20 points, and that's, there's no reasoning for it, but they're Mayo fans, you know. But if you ask the footballing guys, they'll all tell you there's a chance there, yeah. You know, if Mayo perform and there's no crazy act of God, then you never know.
My nieces are from Kildare. My niece and nephews are in Galway. So once they're able to speak, we teach them how to sing the green and red of Mayo. So that's just part and parcel of being from Mayo, and or having anybody that's connected to you from Mayo. You have to learn all the words to that song. So
they're on about the curse, or they're on about Paddy Prendergast and this, that and the other. Paddy Prendergast is the last surviving member of that team. One of nature's gentlemen. He's living down in Tralee. His brother was full back for Mayo in the 70s and 80s, and he had another brother too as well, fullback for Mayo as well. So the Prendergast name is synonymous and it's famous with Mayo football here. And I hope the man lives to lead the 100 and more.
Yeah, I mean, you always get snippets of people who are away, and I suppose that's the other great thing. People who are living away, maybe in the other side of the world, that are able to fly their flags and do all that. But I suppose the most extreme thing is in Ballina, the guy that painted his house. Did you go and see it today?
No.
He painted his house red and green, and he's raising money, I think, for the new sensory park they're building in Ballina as well. But yeah, it's proper red and green, like red and green boxes and squares all over his terrace house. So I think that's probably the most committed I've seen. Although, again, go back to the nail bar today. I asked them, were they doing many red and green and Mayo for Sam nails? And yes, they had a few, and they showed me a few pictures. And some lady got her nails painted Mayo for... got them painted red and green and got Mayo for Sam written on them, and she was off to dye her hair red and green later on. So that's pretty extreme. I didn't go for anything just like that yet. I'd hate to be walking around next week. I'd get an awful slagging from the two boys if I'd red and green hair next week.
Have you allowed your head to go to the place where Mayo do lift Sam, and what does that look like here in Mayo for the days afterwards?
I've often thought, you know, obviously you think about it. You think, how would it pan out? You know, McHale Park's been resurfaced, so there'll probably be no homecoming there.
Or is it being resurfaced for the homecoming?
yeah, that's it. No, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows, because we've never experienced anything close to it or in that magnitude in Mayo. I think everyone will just go to their towns and stand around and expect something to happen. I don't know. I don't know what's actually going to happen. I mean, do people... do they go to the pub? If you don't drink, what do you do? Do you stand outside the pub and clap? Or, you know, I think there'll be a lot of driving around. I know, like, in the towns like Westport and Castlebar, after a good semi-final win, you'll get people driving around for half an hour after it beeping.
Yeah.
I don't know. God knows what had happened. I'd say there'll be nothing done for a week or two anyway. You know, it'll be shut down. Don't be expecting anything done in Mayo if Mayo winning on Ireland.
For Tyrone to win this game, they're going to have to die in that football pitch, because I know the Mayo lads are going to put their full effort into that, and they're going to go out in their shields one way or another, in victory or in sorrow. So Tyrone, be ready for that.
Right, good stuff, Owen. They're as committed off the field as they are on the field, it turns out.
Absolutely. And do you know what? I'm loving this whole idea of talking about what will happen if you win. Don't get wrapped up in, oh, we can't possibly entertain that discussion until Saturday at 7 o'clock at the very earliest. I'm loving the fact that everybody's allowing their mind to wander and to think about what the glory might actually entail, because I guess that's the whole point, isn't it? That's the whole thing that keeps all these Mayo people coming back. And in fact, that's what keeps this Mayo fan group growing, because I think it is constantly growing. I think it's like a boulder gathering moss rolling down a hill, especially over the last 10 years. It has just gathered momentum year after year. And this time, for the first time since that boulder has started rolling, they're favourites. They're real favourites in an All-Ireland final. Dream away is what I say. And do you know what? I mean, if you told me that that was going to be the tone of the piece throughout, or if you told anybody what the tone of the piece would be throughout, you might actually think of a phrase such as arrogance or something like that. You can't possibly listen to that and think that there's any sense of arrogance whatsoever. It's actually quite a nice way of depicting confidence. It turns out you can actually do that in a real way.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Go on.
Well, you obviously turned into Alan Partridge once you crossed the Shannon somehow about the boulder gathering moss. That's fair enough. I understand. You've got a bit native. And, is it not just a little bit delusional? Is there something in the water? Like, I don't know. You're there.
You go on. You're delusional. I want to hear this out. I want to hear this. Mayo fans are delusional. Tell us why.
Well, you're talking about them planning their victory and what they're going to do when they win, and you're saying there's a good thing for them. I would just be a little bit cautious. I think certainly Larita was a bit cautious when she was talking about the women in the nail bar, saying, "Should we have this already won?" You know, I think any of us from a county who is not a traditional winner is always very concerned about, isn't it great he's going to get his medal now? And you're like, no, that's not how it works. You don't get the medal until you've won it. You've got to actually win it in the field of play. I don't think in Tyrone that the women in the nail bars are like, oh, isn't it going to be great for Sludden or whoever? Oh, he's got his medal now. Or all those lads. I don't think that's happening.
We'll soon see. And I don't think I'm not sure. Like, I'm not sure anybody in that piece is necessarily saying that. I think what I'm referring to is that they're allowing their mind to wander as a fan. Let's also remind ourselves that none of the people that we're speaking to this week are actually playing.
Saturday. They're meeting the team. That's the air that seeps in, just like the fear crept into the Kerry setup when it was Tyrone. And geez, you got to check under your pasta when you're playing against those guys. That was the bang of that.
Well, what do you want? What do you want? Do you want fear or do you want confidence? Because you're saying both things here.
Well, I want the game will be decided on the field. Let's wait and see.
I mean, there is literally no point breathing.
From Mayo, I want
no
a little bit of fear. I don't want them to go. I just don't want them to hit the wall and realize that that was the wall that we were heading towards. Right. Okay. I didn't realize that was the wall. I'm worried about what the mood in Mayo will be like if Tyrone do what I expect Tyrone to do at the weekend or in the replay. Whenever that happens, I think at the end of this year, Tyrone have a bigger, stronger panel of full choice. All their players are coming fit. No Killian O'Connor, Oisin Mullen on one leg. Other injury doubts about Mayo. I don't know. I make Tyrone favourites, and I just hope that Mayo are leaving a little bit of space in their hearts for what happens if they lose. Just one thing, two things. Did you have a medium?
No, I didn't actually. I just had a regular pint. Didn't have a medium. Just a good old fashioned pint, obviously incredible, best pint around in McBurns. Not this time, but I will have to come back and get one of those. I think during COVID, you know, maybe time is precious, and wasting precious time drinking pints that aren't fully full, maybe not the wisest tactic when you've got to be out of a place at 11 or 11:30.
It's a flex from you. Okay. The other thing was a lot of talk about Paddy Prendergast, right? But he isn't the only surviving member of the last Mayo team to win an All-Ireland, is he?
Well, like, this is something that, like, yeah, he's not. In today's parlance, obviously, it would be a case where there would be two living members of the Mayo team, but I think we're still living in the world that existed pre the 1980s, 1990s, where the subs were the subs and they didn't really count unless they came off the bench and did something spectacular. Yesterday, I caught up with Dr. Mick Loftus, who lives out in Cross Malina. He was a non-playing sub in 1951, but he very much has an All-Ireland medal from 1951. So no, Paddy Prendergast is not the only living member of that squad who is alive. There's also Dr. Mick Loftus, who went on to have an incredible career in Gaelic games. He went on to referee two different All-Ireland football finals. I think it was 1965 and 1968. And then he also went on to be president of the GAA itself. So this guy is a legend in administration, but also a legend when it comes to one of the most famous GAA teams, I think it's fair to say, in history. It is the 1951 team. I went to his house yesterday, and I also spoke to his granddaughter, Rosanna, who we'll hear in the piece. But we're going to start here with Dr. Mick describing the morning of the 1951 All-Ireland football final and the journey to Dublin.
Just went up by Kerr, you know. And there was no bus or anything like that. But anyways, you know, it took us a while. We stopped on the way up in Longford and the usual waits. But against that, it was a great feeling. Be going up to playing in All-Ireland, you know. And there was a great bunch of fellas, great comrades, you know, that were very much together. I think that's what stood to them a lot, was the combination.
He's my grandfather and someone who's instilled into me the importance of the GAA community. I know it's probably fairly obvious online, but we're very close, myself and himself. We've travelled around Ireland together, gone to All Stars together. I am in awe of him. He's a great man and I'm so proud he's still here, especially at 92, and we have these memories together.
Going on the pitch or something else. Of course, I had been on the pitch with the minor team in 47 when, believe it or not, Tyrone beat us in the final.
Nice.
In the minor final in 1947. And we were leading by 6 or 7 points before half time, and we let it slip. We sat on our hunkers.
He talks about his teammates fondly, who passed him the ball, who, you know, who he travelled with in the car to the games. And definitely teammates are important, and he's really close to Cross Malina, his club here.
It was a great squad, one of the best. And I'm not saying that because I was part of it, but they were a great team. I think from the goalie right up to the full forward, it was a very good team. There wasn't any weak link on it. And I think they should have won another or two with Ireland. And please God, this team and me are up to them.
Do you remember the celebrations in 1951 and how you felt at the full-time whistle?
Yeah, well, we came back to Barry's Hotel and we had our celebration there. And on our way home, you know, we didn't come as a block, although we drove into individual cars and stopped on ways down. But there was no big celebrations. When we came to Ballinair, there was a reception for us, which, you know, would be expected. Having got to an All-Ireland and winning at the last step.
When he starts talking about 1951, always something new comes out, or a new thing he remembers, and he builds upon that story of getting to Croke Park, going out for the team picture, the team winning, going back to Barry's Hotel, and then travelling home, of course. So yeah, it's great that he can still remember that day, being 92.
Can I ask about Foxford? Is it true about the funeral, stopping on the way home?
I don't remember that at all. I've heard so much about it, and I've only never heard anything about the funeral. No funeral was ever brought to our notice.
So back in 1951, if subs didn't play, they weren't awarded a medal. And at some stage, I believe it could have been the 90s, the GAA awarded All-Ireland medals to non-playing subs, and then they retrospectively gave it back to players. So my grandfather and Paddy Jordan both received their All-Ireland medals from 1951. He was a non-playing sub on that day. He has the medal. He's very proud of his teammates that day. He talks about them fondly, and those that are gone to God. But it is, I'm very strong about making sure it's known he was a 1951 team member.
How big a moment is this weekend for the family?
Absolutely massive. We are so proud of Conor. I think even the semi-final game there against Dublin, you know, he demonstrated the player that he has grown into, a safe pair of hands at midfield, again with Matty, with Jeremy, with Stephen Cohen. I know Andy said it on the pod last week, you know, they are All-Ireland champions from minor to under 21. Those boys have done it, and seeing Conor now midfield, coming into the final, like, we were so proud of him, and I know he'll do great this weekend.
He has come on so much in the past year, you know, to come from the minor on to the senior, it's a great step, and he's playing very well at centre field. Nearly wins back days of my own.
You're very proud of him, are you?
I am naturally proud of him.
Will they do it? Will they win?
That's the burning question. The easy answer is it'll be a 50-50 game. And that's how I think it will be. But that it's hard to pick anyone, any team. But it will be a 50-50 game. Tyrone are good players. They're a very good team.
Yeah, McLoftis, 92. He knows the crack. That's exactly the right answer. I don't know what's going to happen. Let's wait and see what happens on the day, Owen. Isn't that correct? No, he's gone. Will on YouTube says, all these feel-good vibes towards Mayo. Tyrone will lap that up. Lads, it's 31 versus Tyrone. These Northerners love that type of fuel. It is absolutely grist to the mill of the Tyrone crowd, that Northern crowd, as they would be known further south than this part. If you want to get involved this morning, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. You can use the hashtag OTBAM, or of course you can leave a message on the YouTube channel for us. Between now and 10 o'clock, here's what's coming up on OTBAM. We've got John O'Mahony and Willie Joe Padden. We've got Liam McKay. Today's our Mayo love-in, by the way. I should have just warned you at the start. today is our Mayo Love-In, all the way up until 9 o'clock when we're talking hurling with James Scowell. We've got Lee McHale, Mike Finnerty. We're going to talk here from Leona Maguire, speaking with Aisling O'Reilly at her homecoming yesterday. It was a day for homecomings, because also going to hear from Ellen Keane, who came home to Clontarf in Dublin. Leona Maguire came home to the Slieve Russell in Cavan yesterday. And then John Walters, pretty hard-hitting stuff from John Walters. He's not impressed by what he's seen so far from the Republic of Ireland in this World Cup campaign, and that's between now and 10. This is the Mayo All-Ireland Special on OTBAM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Owen, obviously, in Mayo for the last couple of days, chatting to some of the most passionate fans and greatest footballers. Tomorrow, don't worry, we'll be live from Tyrone. If you miss anything from either show, you'll catch it back on the OTBAM podcast feed or on the Off the Ball YouTube channel. Here's John O'Mahony and Willie Joe Patton. Enjoy.
Can we talk about Tyrone in 89 then? It's obviously going to be quite prescient this week given the opposition. It is the bandage game, Willie Joe, for people who aren't familiar. What are your overall recollections of that game when you first think of that match with Tyrone?
Well, just before the game, everybody, Tyrone in particular, I think they just came down and said, well, you know, we have to play Mayo. We're going to be in the final now. Now, they were in the All-Ireland final in 86 and they were beaten by Kerry. But in fairness, we had different ideas. And I remember them coming unfinished business because there was their T-shirt that they were wearing. And we knew that. So obviously, we had it well. The well sussed out, and you know, to us it was another game and we had to get stuck into it, and we have a chance here of making the All-Ireland final. That's the way we've seen it. We've seen it as certainly we were in there with a 50-50 chance, where I think Tyrone maybe had underestimated us slightly. But as the game turned out, we just got stuck in, and yeah, I ended up with this bandage on my head, or I think I'd
so what happened?
Well, I was running across the field for a ball and one of the Tyrone lads was running out, and I went down to pick up the ball and his knee just hit off my head, and I got up, nothing. Then I could feel the old blood coming down, so I was whisked out to the sideline, and Frank Davey put a couple of stitches in me, and I could hear Jonathan saying, get him back out and Frank took out this wrap, wherever he got it, and a cap on top of that, so I ended up going out. I didn't know what was on my head actually going out, but I said, here goes, I gotta go here.
Yeah. Where was your compassion, John?
It was one, well, it's one of the iconic pictures. I talked to Frank Davey actually yesterday about it. I think it was when we got over the hill and won the game. I think the fundraising started in earnest, and I think that same cap was auctioned about 20 times as the original, and I think there was a little bit more than Willie Joe's blood on the other ones. But it was I do remember the scene on the sideline, poor old Frank. I was putting pressure on him because we didn't want to make a substitute or anything else. You know, we wanted him back where we needed him, and it worked out, and it was a moment that has been recollected, and I see the pictures in every preview whenever Mayo are there again. It's always there. So look at it. It's one of those memories. But it was the unfinished business thing that Willie, it was a bit naive of them to, you know, they were pictured on the paper with this unfinished business. So behind the four walls of the dressing room, I think it's safe to realise it now. Well, you know, we're going to finish their business, you know, rather than, you know, in fairness, they had been 6 points up against Kerry in 86, and they had got a penalty, and the penalty was sent over the bar. So if that, they'd have been 9 points up if it was a goal. It was 7 points up, but I think Kerry won it by 6 or 7 points in the end. Pat's Blan got a goal, but it was that, you know, we felt that we were there to ambush them, and that was the thing. And that particular year in the Connacht Championship, we drew with Galway and beat them well in the replay. We had the famous it went to extra time, which was common in the replay above in Hyde Park, where we were. It was an amazing. That was an amazing game, but the resilience of the team that day was brilliant, in the sense that we were three points down, I think, or 4 points down, and Roscommon got a penalty, 4 points ahead, and Roscommon got a penalty and put it in the net when it was 2 points actually, and
to go the point ahead,
and we had it rehearsed that, you know, like. the natural reaction in a game like that, if that happens, you put the heads down and you think. So we had it rehearsed, if this happens, Gabriel Irwin's to take a ball quickly out of the net out and have it placed, and within seconds it was kicked out and it was down at the other end. And actually, I think Micheál Collins or someone had it in the net, but he called it back for a free 14-yard free drawing game. They went ahead again then, and Jimmy Bourke got what we call the famous pushover try. He kind of hit it with his shoulder and his knee, being touted for rugby league the next week. Kind of. So in that sense, we had come through a lot of battles, and we knew that this game was going to be difficult. But Tyrone got a goal midway through the second half to go 2 points ahead. It was a very low scoring game. There was no blanket defences, but it was low scoring. I think 12 points to 1-6, and they got a goal to go a point ahead, and we got the 4 points after that. We won 12 points, so there was no panic, and I think that was again something that was a benefit of our mental preparation, that if you panic about things, you're unlikely to solve them, whereas if you keep calm and do something to solve them, you can. And that worked there, and nearly worked in the final, but didn't. Yeah. You know,
the unfinished business thing clearly would motivate you as a player.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, like, I mean, the first thing you'd think of, well, is there any point of us going up here at all, if that's the, you know. Yeah. So but then you'd redouble your resolve then, and yeah, certainly say, well, we're going to give it a right shot here. But we weren't underestimating ourselves by anything, now, because we knew we had a good side, and yeah, you know. Yeah. And we would have stood up at the best there, to be quite honest, and that's the way we felt. Mm. And that's the only way you can feel when you're going out playing in the final. You have to believe that you can win it, or a semi-final, you have to believe that you can win it. And it's no different to any game, so it just redoubled our efforts to make sure that we were going to win the game.
How did you play after the knock to the head?
Well, I think you have to ask John about that one.
We did fine. Every time you went near the ball, the stand erupted. Stand erupted, you know.
Maybe he's saying, maybe I should have left him on the sideline.
No fear.
Which is one other thing I just wanted to ask you about at that time in particular, John, is about your backroom team, because it's very interesting. Two names that pop up that perhaps some people forget were in your backroom team around that time were Tommy Gorman and Eddie O'Sullivan. Did you bring both of those in?
No, just to clarify, Tommy Gorman was with me in Mayo, in the sense that, like, it was like at that time, nowadays, if you see in Crow Park, I mean, the Dublin backroom team, 25 or 30 people and so on, we didn't have. I mean, I went to training in 89 with all the footballs and all the bollards in the boot. Mm-hmm. There wasn't even, there was no such thing as kit vans or anything else. So it was, I did first aid courses. I was strapping ankles, all that kind of. You were nearly, Charlie Collins, Christy O'Hare, Mick Higgins, and Shamey Daly. And Shamey was brilliant for me. He was really mentoring me as a manager, because he had trained the 1970 team that won the league, and he was came in as a selector, and he was absolutely brilliant in the sense that he would have, as the man says, he was good with the county board and dealing with them and all of that. So it was a good backdrop. But we did have Tommy Gorman then was helping out with the, he used to do the previews of the game at that time for RT, and he said to me one day, if I can help or whatever. And it all started there, really. And when I was Leitrim, and I did it in Galway. Eddie O'Sullivan was in Galway. I was Eddie, right, on board, where effectively he used training in a gym, and I was trying to get, at that time strength and conditioning was very important. He had the rugby background, but he had a lot of knowledge, and he came on board, and halfway through the year he was appointed coach of the USA rugby team. So he devised all the different training plans and all of that, so there was a lot of faxes flying between the west coast of America and during that season. So that's where that, but it was, in other words, you were getting people's expert and advice, and I'd always have an open mind. This is about winning. It doesn't matter who gets every, like, and I'd say to the players as well, if we win, everyone is a winner in this dressing room. So it wasn't about egos or anything else. We were trying to get the unity of purpose there, and though I'd be forever grateful for all the expert advice that I would have got from people, you know, whether it was nutrition or food or whatever, we tried to lift the bar and to break the ceiling in every way we could. So all of that and the diet sheets, and Willie, I don't know whether Willie Joe had them off by heart or not, but it was my wife Geraldine happened is a home economics teacher, so she had done a lot of stuff on the food side of things, so it was all a kind of a voluntary thing, you know. So we did it. We it was very enjoyable, and there was great fun in it at times, as we've alluded to, and that's what I'd hope, that fun is still there. But it's a serious business now, you know.
Yeah. What sort of recipes are we talking, Willie Joe, during that era?
Took me a while to get into the diet sheet, because hence I have to do the extra training down the Lack and Strand. So I said, maybe this is read those sheets, maybe I might have a better chance.
There was a tradition at the time that I remember when I was training for Mayo, like as a player, you went down after training, you got a big steak before the championship and chips, and you were drinking Lucozade or Club Orange and club milks afterwards. And when I think back, I said, Jesus, we have to change this anyway. So like, probably when I introduced the salads and all this kind of thing, the boys thought, well, here's the county board cutting the budget.
The Kerry fellas are probably on big steaks down there now. Yeah. We're getting the salads.
The lettuce coming out our ears here, you know, but it was for a good reason.
A good reason and a good cause. Two Mayo legends there speaking with Owen. This Thursday morning at 11 minutes past 8, very busy show between now and 10 o'clock. We're going to hear from Leon Maguire. We're going to hear from Ellen Keane. We're going to talk hurling with James Skell and the managerial merry-go-round, and particularly those rumours about Davy to Galway. Up next, though, Owen chats with Mayo legend Lee McHale.
OTB AM.
Oh, Mayo!
All right. Episode 18 of the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. It's All-Ireland Final Week. Anything to say, boys?
No, it's great to be here. It's
how would you stop?
He's just spent 10 minutes of pre-recording singing The Green and Red of Mayo and the N70, you name it. I've never seen a man as excited in my life.
I was up in the Fina on Saturday, in the club in the Fina in Dublin, and I was talking to a couple of Dublin guys, and the kids there were 10, like, John, this just shows how Dublin have destroyed their championship, right? And they were saying the first time they ever seen Dublin really losing was against Mayo and the kids. And the first time this September that Sam Maguire will not be going into a school in Dublin. So they don't know what to do with themselves, do you know?
Kiddies. I'm telling you, I've done a few of those gigs now with the schools. The kids were getting bored of it as well. They had no interest. They started looking, can Liverpool bring in the Premier League? And the teacher's like, no, we got the lads in again with this cup.
Yeah, what's rare is wonderful. Next year it'll be a bit different if it's 2 years in a row. That is the bit of that we're going to play you, because you're going to have to go and download it yourself. The episode 18 of the Football Pod, the All-Ireland Football Final Preview with Paddy and Andy. Available now to listen wherever you get your podcasts, as Andy Moore and Paddy Andrews build up to the All-Ireland Final. Make sure you get the OTB Sports app now, because every episode, including next week's episode, will have an exclusive 24-hour window only available on the OTB Sports app. That's where most people are actually listening to it these days. So you're not part of the cool crowd if you're not doing it that way. And it'll be there next Tuesday, dropping around midday for you. So get the OTB Sports app, free gratis and for nothing. This is our Mayo All-Ireland Football Final special on OTBM. The Tyrone special is coming for you tomorrow. Owen spent the last 2 days in the county chatting to some of their most passionate fans and greatest footballers. Lee McHale is certainly in that bracket. He's one of the best footballers that county has ever produced. He's going to be in Croke Park for Off the Ball this Saturday for the All-Ireland Final. Yesterday, Owen popped out to his house in Mayo to talk football, Ballina and basketball's influence on the sport.
All right, we are here in your beautiful home, Liam. I think it's fair to say here in Ballina. Thanks a million for having me.
No problem.
Have you? You've always lived in and around Ballina, haven't you? You've always stayed put in Mayo.
Yeah, I'm a townie. Was born in and bred in Ballina town. I lived in a street called Corcoran Terrace. The town was divided regionally for the town leagues when we were kids playing Gaelic football and basketball, and we were from the area called the Pats. And we produced an awful lot of good footballers and athletes and basketball players and soccer players out of that area. And in fact, we went 16, the Ballina Stephen Knights went 16 or 17 years on without winning a county title. We won it in 85. And I think there was 11 or 12 of us from the Pats area, from this one area, on the team that won the county title. So we'd be very proud of our street and very proud of the fact that we're all Pats men. And obviously the McStays were on that team, Porrick Ward, the Gillivaries, all those great players, the Tigers. So we had great times growing up. And I think it was about 19 years ago when we got married, we moved out to enemy territory. Now we live in Knockmore, and obviously Knockmore and Ballina at club level would have been serious rivals over the years. But the funny thing was, and I'm sure it's the same in a lot of counties, that we all went to school together. We all went to Muirdex and Moyne College, and we would have played with each other at schools level and enjoyed it and had success at that. And then we would have played against each other at underage level and senior level. And it was very strange because Cross Ballina and Ballina and Knockmore, we all live within a 7 mile radius of each other. And there was one time there in the 80s and 90s when we were probably three of the best teams in the country, you know, regularly getting to provincial finals and All-Ireland finals. So we were very fortunate. We had the Gaelic football and the basketball going well when we were that age, when we were in our 20s and early 30s, and it was just a great time.
What was the main pull for you to stay? Was it sport? Was it basketball and the success you were having with that sport?
Well, it wasn't really, because the basketball was going very well, and I played club football, but the club football was only secondary. Football was only secondary. It was only a pastime, you know, to keep me fit during the summer and stuff like that. I was offered a couple of scholarships. In fact, one guy, a guy, Lord rest him now, came, Eddie Burke was his name, the coach of Drexel University, came to visit me for a week, and we had a great time together, and he really put pressure on me to sign for a good Division I school in Philadelphia, and I was sorely tempted. And in fact, when I hurt my ankle before the Cup, I think it was in 1990, I think it was, he flew me over, all expenses paid, and I went to the college and was there for 5 days, and they just worked on my ankle for the whole 5 days and nearly got me back in time to play, but the ligaments were too badly torn. But I would have seriously taken up that scholarship or one of those scholarships, but around 1918, 1919, I started playing for Mayo. John O'Mahony brought me in, and my first full game for Mayo was an under-21 All-Ireland final against Cork and Ennis, and I started really getting into it then, and I liked the higher level, and I liked playing with the other guys in the county, and believe it or not, people don't know that, but that was the reason I decided not to go to the States and play ball, because the basketball was going great and we were becoming a very, very good team and I was enjoying that. But all the managers, fortunately for me in those days, were accepting of the football managers, were accepting of me playing the basketball during the year and then playing football in the summertime. Now, I always made myself available for the league, but I didn't play in much league matches. I would have played 20 minutes here, 30 minutes there. Most managers wouldn't have started me in league matches. So for me, it worked out great, but it obviously that can't happen now because I suppose the game is so demanding, there's so much time, you know, spend off the field studying tape on your own and, you know, all that conditioning work that they have to do that you wouldn't be able to do it now. But I was lucky that I could do it then.
Because it's been a big talking point this year, Liam, the whole idea that the Mayo players are at home now and they're not travelling over and back from Dublin. So when did you notice that this was starting to become a thing? Was it actually starting to come up during your playing days, the fact that people would start to leave Mayo but still trying to get back to play, and all of a sudden you had players dotted around the country?
Yeah, it was very difficult. We've always experienced that. We'd always have 8 or 9 guys in Dublin, and they would have to train during the week, 2 nights a week, and then come down and work with us at the weekends. And that's not ideal. It's not too bad if they're in college, but when we had that mature team that we had in 89, they got to the All-Ireland final. Most of the guys that were living in Dublin were working in Dublin, they weren't in college, so they weren't getting home at all. Like, they weren't getting home for the summer. So we all would be without 5 or 6, 7, 8 guys for training during the week, and it was always a hindrance. And your point is very well made on that. The Mayo have been very, very good now for a number of years. We've been knocking on the door for a long time, and I think we've played in 10 All-Ireland finals now since 89, and 6 or 7 of them, 8 of them have been in the last 15, 20 years. And so we have been good, but we were supposed to be in transition because we've lost so many players in the last 2 years. And we've been in the All-Ireland final last year, and when they're All-Ireland final this year. And I don't think many people expected that with all the guys that we lost. But I would agree with you 100% that the fact that these kids are at home and not in college and have everything is shut down, so all they have time to do is condition themselves and get themselves right to play when they're allowed back to play. And I'd say these guys have, you know, they've eaten, slept, drank Gaelic football and Mayo for the last 18, 19 months. And it's paying dividends now.
How happy would you be to see something like that sustainable into the long run? Because, like, we've spoken quite a lot about rural depopulation and all that down through the years. You'd have seen it firsthand. Maybe even basketball in Ballina is emblematic of it. The good old days are long in the rearview mirror. How much would you love for a sort of rekindling of a place like Ballina on that sort of level, for example?
Well, this remote working, I think, is a necessity for rural towns. You know, you have a town like Ballina. We had a top-class basketball team. We don't have any more because everybody goes away to school or to college or goes away to work. You know, Ballina, Cross Malina, as I mentioned earlier, and ourselves were three of the biggest clubs in Connacht, if not in the country. Not more won the county championship last year, which was great to see. But Cross Malina are operating out of Division 2, and we've lost two county semi-finals. So we're not the powers that we used to be because we just don't have the players around during the week. Now, most of them would be students, but they're still not here till you know, April, maybe even May. So you're working out January, February, March, April, maybe, with doing practically no training during the week. The guys come home on Friday, they're tired, you do a light session and you maybe have a league match or a challenge match on a Sunday and they go again, and that's not enough to sustain and to develop a team that's capable of winning a county title and maybe going on like we used to say 15, 20 years ago. And you see the teams in the Midlands and up around Dublin, they seem to have better facilities, and they have their guys at practice, you know, Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday. So they're getting double the amount of work done as a group as we would be, say, here in North Mayo. So, or in Mayo, like, I think it's the same for every club in the county now. So, and there's loads of counties in the same sort of position that we're in. So I just hope that, you know, with this pandemic, you know, terrible and all it was, that there can be some positives come out of it, and that there will be allowed people, young people will be allowed to work remotely and maybe stay at home and be able to practice at home and play at the weekends and make the team stronger simply by their presence.
Yeah, because there seems to have been, certainly during the boom of the last 10 years before COVID, there seemed to be a connection between success in your personal life, education, work, whatever it may be, and moving to Dublin or something like that, whereas it does feel that this could perhaps change that perception a little bit.
Yeah, I hope so, because we're like, you know, Ballina was a vibrant town 20 years ago. It's still a beautiful town, it's a great town to live in, but it's not near as busy as it used to be. And you know, you 100 professional couples move back into the likes of a town like Ballina, and maybe have to work in Dublin 2 days a week would make an awful difference to a town the size of Ballina, and maybe try and attract more industry and keep our young people at home if we could. And then it'd make an awful lot of difference to the whole community, sports wise and economically and everything. It's nice for families to have their family at home as well, but absolutely, it'd be lovely if that could happen. It'd be one positive thing that came out of this pandemic.
Like I said earlier, there was a boom before COVID. Like, I mean, the west of Ireland certainly felt the crash. Maybe didn't even feel the boom when it happened. Yeah. So I probably am speaking a little bit out of turn there. I'm sure that even places like Ballina didn't really reap the full benefits of the years leading up to 2020.
Yeah, yeah, it has been a struggle now, and you would miss the young people around the town. And you go back to Stephenites on a Tuesday night in January to see training, and there's 16 guys on the pitch, and you know, you count then how many senior players are there, and there might be six, and you just can't develop a strong competitive team that way. And I know it's unfortunate that's the way it is at the moment, but I hope that can, the way it was for the last 18, 19 months, it can stay that way for the most part, and that the big teams, I know I'm a bit biased, but the big teams in the North Mayo area and in general will have more people back, and that they'll be available for training, and it will develop that way again.
What is the situation with basketball in Mayo at the moment?
It's not near as strong as it was. We still have a club. It's an underage club. We go as far as under 16. We produce some good players. The last good group we had, in fact, was Conor Loftus's group. Conor would be about, 27, 28 now, I would say. So it would have been 10 years ago. We had a very good underage group there. They lost an All-Ireland final schools title. But out of the 12 on that roster, 9 of them went away to college. So we figured that even though they were very keen to play National League basketball, there was no point in us bringing in 2 Americans and having maybe 3 senior players at home with 2 Americans, 5 in total, and maybe 7 away, and only coming home tired on a Friday night. So it wasn't sustainable. And you know, in basketball at Super League level, you're going to be spending some money, especially if there's some professionals in your ranks. So it just was something we couldn't do. But maybe down the road, if this system comes into place where people are living back in their hometowns, maybe we could get back into having a senior team in the town, which would be absolutely marvellous again, because really in the winter time, when there's not a lot going on, you have a National League team that's going well. It really does pass the winter for the supporters and the players.
Definitely. Is Loftus the only basketballer of note in this squad? Well, obviously Aidan O'Shea played a bit as well, or are there others that we don't know about?
Well, Pádraig O'Hara. Oh, yeah. Pádraig would have played with us at underage level, and like I remember, I was in my 40s, I'd say, at the stage, and he was asked to come up and train with us at senior level, and I was marking him one night, and I switched after about 3 minutes. I said, this fella's too quick for me. He's running all over the place. I was exhausted covering him. So he was always a great athlete. His brother Benji played as well, and never thought I'd see him at the level he's at now, Gaelic football. He didn't play a lot of Gaelic, kind of like myself. He would have loved basketball, but he's turned himself into a fine athlete. He's very, very strong mentally, very, very strong physically, and about 5-6 years ago, he started playing for the Stephen Knights. I coached him 1 year with my brother-in-law, a guy called Shane McCann, with the Stephen Knights. I was in helping out, and he did very well that year, about 6 years ago, and he's just kind of took off since then, and he's a vital member of that Mayo team now, and it's great to see it. But he would have been a very good basketball player, and Connor was a really good basketball player, a very good point guard, you know, a very intelligent player, you know, like the way he is in a football field, doesn't make many mistakes, and is a good leader as well. So they'd be the only 2 I'd know besides Aidan. Yeah.
Would someone like Conor Loftus have conversations with you personally down through the years? I guess because the parallel is there, I guess, with his position, with the fact that he's a good basketball background as well. Have you had, I guess, much communication with players like him and this current crop of young players, and I guess in Loftus's case, kind of middle of the career age players?
Yeah, well, it's gone very secretive now. You meet a guy in the street and you ask him about such and such a guy is injured, and he tell you, I'm not sure how he is, you know. So I don't see Conor much now. He's in Dublin. I met him a few times. I met him at a game in Tala in Dublin there recently. His sister was playing, and I had a chat with him afterwards. But it wouldn't be much about football, and the guys wouldn't be ringing me asking me for advice. I think it's very in house and keep everything to themselves. So you wouldn't hear much now. You know, this Mayo team are very, very quiet. Like it's a testament to them, really, how involved they are together and how tight they are, that nothing really comes out from the camp. We really don't know how Oisin Mullen is. We don't know how Killian O'Connor is. You'll just hear rumours, but you'll hear nothing from the players. And as regards getting in contact with you would talk to them, but you wouldn't. The last thing I'd say the lads want to talk to you about is football or sport, like you know, how they're going in their when they're in with the county.
How big a problem was that before that became the case?
There wouldn't be as much video analysis. There wouldn't be as much strategy when we were playing. There wouldn't be as much. I don't think there was ever a situation where you'd pick a team and 3 guys wouldn't be playing. I can't ever remember, or I couldn't imagine a manager coming up saying, "We're putting you down as a starter, but we're not starting you. You know, we're starting such and such a guy." So it was very. The game was very fluid in our time, and it was very much we'll get you in shape, we'll play this brand of football, we'll move the ball this way, you know, we'll hit the full forward line early, that's what we're doing, and there was no real major secrets about it, whereas now it's gone very technical, and a lot of it is cloak and dagger, really. You know, you can't even go to a game sometimes, you can't get in to see an in-house game, you know, a scrimmage game between a team now, that's just the way it is, whereas before when we were playing there could be 300 or 400 watching an in-house game. So it's totally different now. It's way more tactical, and you know, the way the keepers are playing now and the way the defences are set up, you know, they're dropping this guy, they're dropping that guy, this guy is helping on the weak side, so it's it's just totally different. But in our time, you could go down the street and you could stand up there and have a coffee with a guy, or sit down and have a coffee with a guy, and you could be talking about the team and going through everybody, like how everybody is going, you know. But it's different now, for sure.
You think there's basically just more to protect nowadays? Yeah. There's more secrets to protect.
Yeah, well, they're like, these guys are doing studies or video sessions now, VT sessions for like 3 hours at a time, and they're getting sent stuff on the phone themselves, and they want to know what foot this guy kicked with. Is he kicking 80% with his left? He only kicks 60 with his right. They're gone into that sort of, like American football, they've gone into that sort of detail. And these guys, the new guys now, can't function without that. If you don't give them that sort of detail, they find it very difficult to play. But that's just the way it is. Mm. I would like to think that if I was marking you, I'd have you figured out. Well, I suppose it's kind of from a basketball team. I'd have you figured out after 5 minutes. I'd know your tendencies anyway. Mm. That I'd figure it out myself, that I wouldn't have to look at you for hours on end on video. You know? So it's changed, but that's just the way it is now.
Has football caught up in that regard then? Because, like, I mean, that's one of the things they say about players like yourself, that you'd better coaching, that your movement was better, your defending was better because of playing basketball. Has football caught up in regards to those skills that we used to refer to as basketball skills?
Yeah, it has, yeah. And, you know, a lot of teams would have a basketball coach in just to do, like, footwork drills them and defensive drills and, you know, when to help, when not to help, all that sort of stuff. And then when you have the ball in your hands, you know, your head is up early. You don't be soloing into cul-de-sacs, which is very important now. You see that happening all the time, fellas. Just they get by one guy, next thing they get excited, next thing there's three Tyrone fellas around you. You get pummeled and the ball is gone. That's not good for anybody, especially yourself. So it has got better, but I see loads of guys making defensive errors, and I wonder, like, say, oh my God, how could you make that mistake when you're watching a game? Your footwork was all wrong, your body position was all wrong. You know, who's coaching you? You know, that kind of way. So, but I think that's just the nature of the beast. Fellas, guys make mistakes. Why did you go and help there and left your man open? But there is a lot more coaching going on, and there's a lot more coaching going on the defensive side of things, and things have improved the last 2 years. It was dour enough there, you know, when Pat was on about puke football. It was dour enough there for long enough, and he was right. But there's high-scoring games now. Teams are scoring goals again. Teams are looking up now and hitting full forward lines and not being outnumbered like 6-2 because of so many fellas back. So the product is a bit better now, Owen, than it was, say, 5 or 6 years ago, for sure. And teams are really going after it. And, you know, the Dubs did it. In fairness, over the years, Mayo have done it. Tyrone are doing it kind of now as well. Kerry have always done it, so it's, and you know, Donegal are playing a good, and Armagh, yeah, are playing a good brand of football now, and it's lovely. I love to watch Armagh playing as well. And, you know, if Galway can get their act together, they're that type of team as well. But I think offensively teams have got better now, and that negative blanket defence isn't working anymore. That there has to be a little bit more sophistication than just getting guys back, because these good teams will pick you apart.
So that seemed to me at the start of the year like a tactical shift or an approach shift. But is there a coaching change as well, Liam? Are you noticing the skills of players changing as well as the approach from the manager, for example?
Well, I would say Curry and Dublin, Donegal would have been very good at Galway, would have been good at it as well, even though they haven't got the results they would like. But the only way you can stretch a team is with good pace, good spacing, and then good ball movement. And if you can kick the ball from your defence out, it takes those extra defenders out of it. And I think that's what you see teams doing. Your cornerbacks, your halfbacks have to be able to kick past the ball now. And that kick pass out the wing is the easiest pass in the game. So I think they're working on, when you win the ball, getting width and then moving the ball at pace and getting it up to that full forward line before the defence is set up. And the good teams are doing that now. And you'll see that a lot on Saturday, because both teams now will defend with everything they have. They'll defend with a fair bit of clarity and understanding, and then they'll look to break.
Because that was kind of one of the things that kind of popped to mind when he talked about that there is this, I guess, more attacking approach around the country, and yet the All-Ireland final this year could be one of the lowest scoring finals in recent years. That's obviously down to the defence. So what makes these two defences so good on Saturday evening?
They're both very, very similar. Mm. Both mad aggressive, both athletic, and both teams are good tacklers. The Bureau forwards are serious tacklers.
Is that down to coaching, Liam? Or, like, can you coach that level of tackling, or would those guys have been identifiable from a young age as great tacklers anyway.
Yeah, well, it's all about footwork and body positioning, and you would imagine that they would have been doing this. And you have to work on it over and over again. Like, you do drills without the ball, then you do drills in one-on-one situations, then you do three-on-threes, and then you have to blow the whistle. This didn't happen in my time because we had to be running all the time and working on our fitness. Now you don't do that. Like, you're expected as a county player to do that fitness level. And you blow the whistle and say, Owen, what are you doing there? You know, your body position is all wrong. Why did you come in from that angle? You know, you gotta get a low stance. You gotta get your body in front of the man. You gotta make yourself big. You gotta hit him, and you gotta push him back and push him into the help. All that sort of stuff. You would imagine the top teams are doing it, so you'd imagine that's going on. Maybe the lesser teams haven't got that quality of coach, and then when you keep practicing that, guys will get better. You have to work on their lateral movement. You know, their footwork. You know, you have to work on the technique of it. You know. Not crossing your legs, not going for mad blocks when you have no help, you know, all that sort of stuff is important. And then you can see like the Mayo guys, the Jeremy O'Connors and Young Donohue and these fellas and Mickey Crines, they're all good tacklers. But the big thing for me is, if you're not brave and you're not prepared to let the guy that's coming at you into your chest, you won't be a good tackler. And they're the fellas that foul a lot. Because when you're coming at me, I have to present myself in a low stance, and I got to try and gobble you up in my chest. And I got to let you in here, and then I try and push it back, maybe get you onto your weak side, force a touch off you and see, can I get that deflection and put the ball on the ground, and then we'll go like dogs and get it off you. But some guys don't like doing that, and you see them putting their hand in at the last minute, and then they get caught for the foul. And that's just bravery. It's very difficult to deal with that. But it does happen. I see it happening all the time, that they want to tackle properly, but they're not prepared to take the hit into the chest and stop the defender in his tracks and maybe turn him onto his weak side or whatever. Doesn't happen now. You won't see that happening too much on Saturday, but it does happen in games, especially at the lower level.
Right. So it is all about the arms. It's about keeping the arms away from
positioning and not crossing your legs and having a good stance and good strong footwork, good strong core. And you have to be brave. You got to hit.
Yeah,
you know, if you're the good tackler, said, you look at Lee Keegan, he'd leather you. And I know he is. I think he had two hip operations, and he's Paddy Durkin. They just love the contact, and they're the good defenders. So they have the technique, but they have the bravery as well. And you do need the bravery. The guys that are fouling, you see their arms coming up, they're protecting themselves, but they're giving away a soft freeze.
You've said there that this is one of the most insulated camps Mayo's ever had. So this is carte blanche for you here. What do you expect in terms of any potential curveballs on Saturday?
Well, we'd all be hoping that Oisín Mullen would play. Aidan O'Shea maybe at full forward, try and go direct, put that full back line as we talked about earlier under pressure, try and get an early score or two. The Dublin are the Tyrones, the Donegals and the Monaghans you don't want to go behind against. So if we find ourselves in the position we found ourselves against Galway on our Dublin, I think against Tyrone we're in big, big trouble. So we can't afford that. So we have to be real aggressive from the start. We can't be going around, you know, lackluster and passive early on. Can't be 6 points down at halftime. That is crucial. So 2 points down or 2 points up is fine, because Mayo have been absolutely outstanding in the second half of those games. So those energy levels and that composure and hunger and will to win is there. But don't come out flat now in the first half, because just the certain teams, and their northern teams predominantly, the good northern teams, if you fall behind, they just know how to suck the life out of the game, you know, force you into tough shots from outside the high percentage range, turn the ball over on you, and then hit you on the break and keep that 5 or 6 point lead. That there's nobody better than the three teams I mentioned. So maybe Aidan O'Shea full forward, maybe he was taken off the last day, maybe do a Peter Canavan out, maybe take him off with 10 minutes to go, ice him down, get him back in then in the second half, because Mayo have to finish strong as well. But we have finished strong in all these other big games, but I think it's going to be very, very tight. I think two very, very tough teams, both mentally and physically, that won't bend a knee for anybody. I think it's going to be attritional. I'd say guys, there could be one or two sent off, it's going to be very, very hard to control your emotions early on, especially the physical players, the real aggressive players, and there's a lot of them out on the pitch. And our guys need to be very, very careful. Like, it's very hard to be at fever pitch and really aggressive and not make a mistake, a stupid mistake with a high tackle or swing an elbow back, because it's going to be, I believe it's going to be that type of game. It's going to be two teams really, you know, really good, banging heads off each other, you know.
On a week like this, Liam, I know you're obviously involved with Athlone at the moment, and that's your coaching gig at the moment. Do you miss the buzz of Intercounty on a week like this, with all the hype and all the conversation around a county like Mayo?
No, I don't. No, I've been involved in it a long time. I played for 12, 13 years, enjoyed every minute of it. I coached, obviously, Mayo with John and George to an All-Ireland final. It was great, with a very young team led by the Mortimers, Trevor and Andy and Alan did, and then James and Alan, of course, was there, and David Heaney. Great group of lads, great fun. And I've been with with Cav, and I've been with Clare, I've been with a lot of teams. And I have to say right now, maybe I'm getting old, you know, maybe I'm just tired, but I have to say now, working with a bunch of young fellas now, a real young team from Athlone, is a breath of fresh air. It's really nice. And right now, sitting here in front of you, and I couldn't see myself rushing back to intercounty football anytime soon, that's for sure.
No, there's a big old merry-go-round of things happening this summer, or this winter, I should say, when it comes to vacancies. Your prediction then, finally, Liam, for this Saturday?
I think it's 50-50. And I think that's all you can ask for in an All-Ireland final. I think if you have a 50-50 chance of winning it, you're in good shape. And I would predict that we'd win it if we start well. We can't afford to be 4 or 5 points down at halftime. So what I'm saying basically is, Owen, if we're 2 points up or 2 points down, at halftime we'll win it.
That's all very straightforward. Liam McHale there in conversation with Owen Sheehan. Owen, that was a learning experience for you. Every day's a school day, but that was a PhD level conversation.
Yeah. Yes, it was. And that's the art of tackling and the art of life, brought to you by Liam McHale. Like, absolutely, you said at the top of the show, what has the reception been like in Mayo? Well, the reception has been absolutely amazing, and particularly in Liam McHale's home there, where I was fed, I was given coffee, I was given a beautiful location there for Liam McHale to shoot in. It was kind of reminiscent of Michael Jordan's shot in The Last Dance, just minus the glass of whiskey.
You should have just fixed the glass of whiskey to ram it home there, you know?
I think so too. It might be the only solution over the next couple of days as well. But yeah, no, interesting stuff there from Liam.
Yeah, so he thinks it's 50-50. Dr. Mick Loftus thinks it's 50-50. There are two men steeped in the history of Mayo GAA. It's only the people and the fans who are allowing themselves to dream. And so, look, yeah, you've won me over. You're right. That's exactly what they should be doing. They should be getting lost this week in the possibility of success and the dream of what life would be like as All-Ireland winners. Why not? That's the whole point of sport, isn't it? You've won me over. Well done.
Were you afraid of, like, Nathan Murphy atting you and dog whistling and the pylon ensuing? Because I can't blame you if that's why you've done a U-turn here.
No. Sometimes when you make a mistake, the thing to do is to hold your hands up and say, right, let's move on. Let's get with the programme. What are the papers saying?
Well, on that very topic, Chair, we're going to get to the Mayo news a little bit later on in the show, because I spent a bit of time with Mike Finnerty out in Westport yesterday at headquarters. There's a couple of other papers that are out already. There's a number of publications that don't come out until Friday, but the Connacht Telegraph and Western People are already out. This is the front of the Connacht Telegraph right there. And the headline, Young, Fearless, Ready. Like, I mean, we could absolutely read into this way too much and say, oh, there's a picture of Oisín Mullanis who's going to be involved at the weekend. But it's more kind of a focus on some of the younger players. There's no Ed O'Shea in that photograph, for example, no Lee Keegan. And that's certainly their angle on things over the next little while. Just want to pick out a couple of things within the Connacht Telegraph. A headline here on page 6, Mayo can break the chains of enslavement after 70 years, which is quite a dramatic headline, I think it's fair to say. The page after it, though, Mayo in pole position to win SAM. So maybe you're onto something, Jerry. You know, maybe there is this sense that they very much are favourites, and maybe the media have gone out of their way to actually encourage that. Plenty of profiling on Tyrone, what to expect from them. Obviously, all the regular media events are covered. This one here, Mayo more than capable of succeeding on Saturday. That is Martin Carney's column here in the Connacht Telegraph. He says that now is the time. Never was there a better opportunity. The extra few weeks preparation has helped and given some of the injured a fighting chance of returning. With encouraged, dogged defending and their indomitable spirit, Mayo All-Ireland Champions 2021 is a real possibility. The other thing is that there's an ad there for McBurn's Bar with hashtag only one plan. That seems to be the catchphrase for this team, the only one plan.
Where'd it come from?
Paul Jagohora post-match interview after the semi-final. We have one plan. And I think everybody knew exactly what he was referring to. I think if they win, it's already an epic interview. That's it, famous, beyond famous already. But if they win, I think it'll be solidified. That'll be their what do you think of that Joe Brawley moment or any other famous kind of post-match interview, except it happened in the semi-final. Just to bring you to Western People, the front page, they're actually bringing you scenes from Mellott's Bar, which is where we spoke to John O'Mahony and Willie Joe Padden. That's in Swinford. They've got an original seat from the Hogan stand, the original Hogan stand there. Then they've got this massive supplement in the middle, and there is the main man himself, Willie Joe, with his bandage there from the Tyrone game in 1989. Just to give you a very quick sense of what's inside this, you've got the gang who refused to disappear is the headline on one of the pages. So I think there is the sense that no matter what happens, Mayo will be there or thereabouts in this game, come from behind in the past. And also, I mean, the headline on a James Horan piece, stubborn, obsessed and still on the hunt for Sam. What's really interesting about the coverage I find this week is that there are a number of profiles being written about James Horan as if he is a new manager, as if he is in his first year in the job. There is a renewed fascination, it seems to me anyway, with James Horan and what he's done his second time around. I think it is a new manager. It is a different person that we're seeing. And then finally, this headline here, Ger, which might be right up your alley, failure is not an option. So not only are they going to win, doing the opposite is absolutely not an option whatsoever. As I say, we'll bring you the Mayo News a little bit later on, but that's a little flavour of the tone that we're getting from the Western People and the Connacht Telegraph.
Okay. Failure is not an option, but it might happen. So how are you getting to Tyrone, Owen? What's the...
They're going to drive. Going to drive north now, any second, and we'll see what happens up there. Should be a good day. We've got plenty of good stuff lined up, and we'll be bringing you that tomorrow on OTBAM. It's obviously I was going to say I've never been there on All Ireland Final Week. I hadn't actually been on. I hadn't been to the Mayo on All Ireland Final Week either myself. So it's going to be a unique experience. We'll be in Omagh later on tonight as well. Hopefully, chatting to a few fans. I know that there's a big preview event going on there. So hopefully we'll come back with a bit of good stuff for tomorrow morning.
Enjoy it, Owen. Good stuff. Safe travels. Thanks a million. That's Owen in Castlebar bringing you the Mayo Papers this morning. It is 8:47. If you want to get involved this morning, we'd love to hear from you. 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. He was also in Ballyhawness, which is obviously now most famous as the home of Nathan Murphy, as opposed to, like, you know, one of the most important towns in Mayo. But here he is getting a sense, Owen, that is, getting a sense of what Nathan's GAA club was like, because that's what it's called.
We have a very multicultural community. We probably have a 30% native Irish community and 70% foreign national, and that's, I suppose, related to the workforces in the town. I suppose prior to COVID, what we did was we really focused on getting players who were new and families who were new to GAA sports and getting them involved. Our little story here, myself and Tab, I mean, we go back, our relationship goes back 30 years. And I was talking to Jerry earlier about this today, about he was actually the manager of our under 14 team back in 1994. And we won the All Ireland. It was a fail-a competition. And myself and Tab featured on that team. Tab is here beside me. Yeah, we featured on that team, as well as our good friend Nathan Murphy. And I know you know Nathan, don't you? so we were present on the team. And I suppose Tab, you know, as the years went on, we went about our own business. I went abroad. Tab did his own thing. And then when COVID came, you know, there's definitely some positives from COVID. You know, some of the lads had an ambition, and fair play to them, to set up a junior football team in the club, because there were so many lads working at home, not doing anything. Obviously, it was having an impact on their mental health. And we said, you know what, let's get a junior B team set up. And it was brilliant. And we brought lads who played football before, weren't probably at the standard of senior football, and brought them up here to the pitch. And I met Tab, I'll never forget. get it down the square one day, and I said, Tab, come on, we're going playing football. And he sort of laughed at me, and I said, no, we're going playing football.
Well, the first came in 1989, and from 1993 onwards, we started playing Gaelic. First time we came up here was as far as the Rochfords, and I started going back, and then I asked the man in the Rochford garage, where's the pitch? And he told me to go further up, past the statue of Mary there. And I came up here and seen some of the lads playing. So from then on, I started playing, and then that's how I met Tomás here with during Gaelic. Otherwise, I wouldn't have met him at all, like, you know.
And where did you come to Ballyhonus from?
Pakistan.
I presume you hadn't heard of Gaelic games?
No, not at all. I barely bit of English at all, but never heard of a Gaelic at all. It was very warm welcome, like, you know. And everyone was with open arms and everything. And then was very good.
The main question I want to know is, take us back to this fella in an under-14s level, this wunderkind Nathan Murphy, I think his name is.
We lost him somewhere on the way. Like, you know,
what happened?
Someone must have taken him away.
I think he got poached by his father, you know, back to soccer. I mean, me always a big soccer man. I was midfield. Tab, we used sort of
full forward.
Yeah. Nathan used to be on the sideline, come onto the pitch as well, and off the sideline again. Only joking, Nathan. He was corner forward. Yeah, he was quick. Good times. We've been hard hit with COVID over the last number of years, our fundraising, but it hasn't stopped us in our own aspirations to develop this club and make facilities better for our kids and the future of Ballyhonus. So we're doing SUV. winanSUV.ie. We're giving away an SUV, or you can cash in your SUV and take €50,000 in cash, and all funds that come in are going towards our development plan for the club to make this place just a better place for everybody going forward.
Yeah, Ballyhonus GAA club there, sounds like a brilliant place, and well done particularly to the lads for surviving Nathan going back to soccer. It's 8:51 this morning here on OTBAM. We'd love to hear from you what you think is going to happen in the All-Ireland football final. We'll be down in Tyrone obviously tomorrow, bringing you what the atmosphere and the mood is around like there as Owen travelled up to Omagh tonight. Reminder, of course, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Now, we want to turn our attention to hurling because, well, it's been a pretty interesting week off the field, and it's going to be an even more interesting week over the next while as we finally get to grips with who is going to be in charge of the various counties. I'm delighted to say James Scahill is back with us. James, good morning to you. How are you?
Hi, Joe. How's it going?
It's very, very interesting off-season so far, and the dominoes started to fall, particularly when Liam Cahill decided to stay where he was, which I have to say I was very surprised by, because it looked like it had all been set up for him to go back to Tipperary, and when he made the decision not to go back to Tip, that was like, okay, right, that's very interesting. So Colin Bonner is officially now the Tipperary boss as well. What do you make of those appointments and those decisions? What does it suggest to you?
First of all, I was very surprised by Liam Cahill staying at Waterford. You know, I was on the show a few weeks back saying that, you know, the role is kind of had opened up from now, and now that it was his time after having gained such experience in Waterford. And I was talking to a Tipperary player a couple of weeks ago, and he was kind of saying that they were sort of half expecting, you know, Liam Cahill to come on board and just transfer over from Waterford. And you know, when I heard the decision about it, yes, I was surprised like everybody else. I thought there was probably a 5% chance of him staying in Waterford. I thought 95% he'd definitely come over to Tip from home. But I really respected his decision. I thought that it was a great show of, you know, I suppose, support to the players that's there, in that he wants to stay with them. And then when you think about it a bit deeper, like, he's going to have, you know, he's going to have Pádraig Mahony and Stephen O'Keefe probably and Tadhg Dé Bruycke back next year. So he's essentially getting three, you know, he's essentially getting three All-Stars back, which, like, in soccer terms is like getting three new transfers, you know, into a team that's already competed against Limerick, you know, pretty well in the semi-final for past periods. So I'd say he's looking at the Waterford position and going, you know, they're probably best positioned to take on Limerick, especially when they get back the couple of All-Stars. So, and what that created then, when Liam stayed in Waterford, it kind of created a bit of, you know, for all those neutrals, a bit of a hysterics, like, who's going to take over the Tip job? And then, obviously, Darry Egan started to get touted about. And then, when he took over the Wexford job, that just threw the whole lot into disarray, you could say. So I'd say the Colin Bonner appointment, I wouldn't call it, you know, a flashy appointment. It's not a huge appointment. Like, what he does bring is extensive experience, and, like, he brings, obviously, he's dealt with Waterford with Fitzgibbons, he's dealt with Ballyhale in All Ireland winning championships, like, he's dealt with Carlow and trying to bring them up levels in divisions of league. So, like, he's not lacking for experience. And, like, I didn't actually realise when I read up more about him over the last couple of days that he's got massive academic qualifications also with numerous areas in S&C and management and whatnot. So I think it's a pretty, you know, it's a safe appointment from Tipperary. Probably it's a good one that they went in-house. I didn't expect them to go out of house, you know, and couple that with the Brendan Cummins appointment at under 20, it shouts to me that it could be an element of natural succession in the 3 years, you know, that Brendan could, you know, go up into senior, a bit like what, I know it's not a hot topic at the minute, but what Stephen Kinney did with the Mick McCarthy appointment, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that seemed to make sense at the time. I think it still makes sense. It's interesting that you bring that up. But the Bonner appointment, I suppose, it wasn't a big splashy appointment because it wasn't one of the names that we had kind of from 6 weeks ago gone, here's an obvious candidate. But when you start to point it out, like what the track record is, what the experience is, the level of success that he's had, and I think particularly important, it's great that you have inter-county success, but it seems more and more important that you actually have Sigerson success, because that means you can speak to younger athletes, you have a proper understanding of the requirements of the work-life balance and the pressure that those kids are coming under to play for their counties, to go training with their counties, to fit that in, and then also manage different styles that they're coming to. That speaks to me of somebody who is perfectly positioned for a team that is transitioning a bit.
Yeah, you made some great points, and like you've articulated better than the way I would have thought about it. And yeah, I fully agree with you, because like when he's coming into a management role, let's say to a team, first of all, that you know, to be honest, they come off back of a disappointed season, but there is a dressing room there of proven winners. You're talking much larger winners in that dressing room. So when he comes in, he's going to have to manage that. And I think the team themselves, like, we know it's not a flashy appointment, but for a manager, it's either respect. He's either respected or he's liked. And, you know, I'd much prefer a manager to be respected coming in. And when you look at his track record over the last number of years, you can't but respect him, because he's done it at most levels, in the sense that he's done it at a third level, he's done it at a club, and he's done it at a county. Like, so he's had a broad range of players over the course of his career, going back, you know, 20-odd years this stage now, when you consider that he managed, you know, JJ Delaney and whatnot in WIT. So like he's coached an awful lot of people, like he's been involved in the game an awful long time. As I said, he brings extensive experience, and I think he'd be well respected in Tipperary. So I think it's a good appointment. Yeah,
I don't know what style of play it's going to be, or do we automatically associate a single style, or is it actually going to be a manager who comes in, looks at the threat of Limerick, looks at the available opportunity that he has with his players, and tries to meld these two things together?
Yeah, well, like, you know, again, I talk to an awful lot of people, let's say, in hurling circles, like, and they're on about, like, oh, if I was over a team, you know, if they were over the team, they would do this with them, but this and that to take on the best teams. So if an inter-county manager is coming in, first of all, do you have the players, like, do you have the ingredients to go implement a game plan that's going to take on Limerick, you know? And if you do, like, you can take on Limerick up front, or do you have a group of players that need to play a certain style to suit them, to get the most out of them? And that's kind of the, you know, it's this kind of 50-50 split. You think about Tipperary, they've always and forever have played a more traditional style, where it's kind of like a 15-on-15, a bit like, you know, McKinney would have done, Galway would have done over and over, and that style nowadays has proven to be unsuccessful against Limerick. So is he going to adopt that style and come towards more what I would class as a modern and contemporary type game, where it's possession based, it's minimal errors, you know, and it's creation of space inside for your forwards? I think that's kind of the way they're going to have to go, because they have, again, as I said about the ingredients, they have the ingredients in Tipperary, where they've got serious pace and they've got great forward threats up there. And when you mix that with a good defensive system and good defence, like, you can keep it tight at the back and you can create space up front. So they have what you would say the tangibles to create, you know, a possession game that could probably take on Limerick. And it's only when we've seen, you know, Cork this year, where they kind of, they went away from let's say, you know, systems they would have incorporated over the last number of years and went to a possession-based game. And again, in their first year, like, I don't know, the final turned out to be hockey in it, but I think Cork made great steps, you know. They make great steps in trying to install the possession game, you know, stick with it, even though they make fundamental errors, they make a lot of errors, and keep going. And, you know, it takes a strong manager. So this, like, when you look at even whoever comes into Galway, and for Colin Bonner as well, it takes a strong manager to understand that if we implement a game plan, and let's say it's not successful in the league, to not abort or to not succumb to outside pressure because their game plan is not successful. You know, people are like, Tipperary people and Galway people alike are very impatient. They want immediate success. So if they lose a league game, they want to win the next one. And you'd have a plethora of people outside of the setup that would want to change things back to a more traditional style that has been proven to win in years previous, but it mightn't be, you know, the best game plan for the future. So pressure will come on the management teams to implement their game style, stick with it, and see where it takes you throughout the course of this season and next season. And he's got a 3-year deal, so, like, you know, the deal is his eye, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think he needs to be allowed to make mistakes as well.
Yeah, and look, there is a slew of young players coming through as well, so it'll be exciting to see what happens there. Did you expect the Galway situation to become vacant? Did you expect Shane O'Neill to step away after last year?
I did, to be honest. You know, I didn't think he'd ever... being honest now, I thought he'd never be pushed out. You know what I mean? I thought he'd always go on his own terms. You know, I do want to say that a couple of his lecturers would have stepped away for family commitments kind of literally immediately after the Waterford game. So, as they've got young families and a plethora of kids. So, it was kind of left to himself and kind of John Fitz and Lucas. And, you know, then the way things transpired, I think just there was kind of a request for change in-house. And I think Shane just probably stepped aside and said, you know, let someone else take up the mantle, because we spoke recently about as well, Ger, about whoever comes in is going to have to somewhat, I won't say rejuvenate the team, that's probably not the correct word, but he's going to have to integrate some new players, get them conditioned and get them ready for senior hurling along with the players that are there at the minute. So it is probably more of a task than probably, you know, are we going to be contenders next year? Yes, we'll always be contenders. You know, we will be. We're not going to be participants, but we'll always be contenders. But I, more than temporary, I do think it's kind of a 2-year process, you know what I mean? Probably 3-year process before we can get back to, you know, a serious contenders and taking on and looking to expect to take on our finals against the likes of Limerick and whatnot.
And yet it felt like they had certainly driven this Limerick team to the pin of their collar at in an All-Ireland final. And it felt like they were built physically to take on Limerick. So why will it take so long, do you think, for the next manager, or why are you asking for time for the next management team to be given to take on Limerick?
Well, I'm being honest here now, okay, and you know this might hurt some people's feelings in Galway, right? But what you have is in Limerick, and Limerick are the model now, and that's it. And we have to keep talking about Limerick because they're the standard bearers. They're like the Bayern Munich in Germany. Everyone's trying to take them down because they're the best. And that's just the reality of it. And they're going to be the best in the near future because every player that comes into their panel, and we've only got a glimpse of a few of them now recently, are conditioned. And so we spoke about before, they're strong and they're really conditioned to take on senior hurling. So like they can have all the skills in the world and they can have all the pace in the world, but if they're not strong and conditioned to be able to take on, you know, basically a war of attrition nowadays in hurling, they're not going to be able to make a positive impact onto the group. And so I'm looking at, being honest, the last 320 groups, you know, they're not conditioned. So, like, our 320 groups now have to get, Lucas has to get his hands on them. That's the most, probably, I digress for a second. The most important thing for Galway in the very, very immediate, in my opinion, is to nail down Lucas, our S&C coach. Give him what he wants, put it on 3-year terms, and give him access to all the players so he can take them and condition them forward into senior. Because right now, I see an awful lot of 120s coming through, and they're just not conditioned. They're lovely hurlers, they're stylish, you know, they've all the silky skill that we can associate with minor 21 teams for 20, 30 years in Galway, but they are not conditioned like you see what the Limerick lads coming through. Look at the 20 final against Cork, and I was astounded, to be honest, when I saw the gap in physicality and size from the Cork players to the Galway players, you know. And like, yes, we can challenge, for probably the majority of the games, but we can't really overtake the likes of, you know, Cork and Limerick without having put in serious conditioning. That's why I say whoever comes in management-wise needs to be allowed a bit of time to get these players conditioned. It takes 18 months. You can be fit in a few weeks. You know, you can be fit, lung fit, aerobically fit in probably 6 to 8 weeks, you know what I mean? But to get a strength base and be conditioned to take on the heat of hurling for a prolonged period of 6 to 8 months takes a year, takes 2 years. And that's why you see Kyle Hicks, Jeremy Burns, Keane Lynch. And like, these guys aren't 30. They're in their low 20s. So they've been conditioned since they were literally 16 up to when they got the integration senior panel. That's the most important thing from Galway's perspective.
Do you get the sense that there is an overarching plan and a structure, and that actually everybody in Galway hurling understands that if you work collaboratively, you're going to get to the point where you've got the raw materials to be one of the dominant forces? Or is it still kind of let's go with this guy now and see what he wants to do, and then the next guy comes along and he's the messiah, and the next guy comes along and okay, this is what we're doing?
Yeah, so like your question basically, are Galway reactive or are they proactive? And like, For me, I have to say we're very reactive, to be honest. I don't think three things, like remember I spoke about Limerick with Ireland, what you need, you know, for the portion of success. So like, you need all the clubs aligned together. You need all the players who are in symmetry with their management. You know, you need financial backing that's going to be able to challenge the big counties, you know. You need structures in place to for the players you know, for them to really thrive. And like when you look at Galway, and first of all, it was a sin that we ever let Micheál Donoghue go. You know, like the a manager like we don't win at Ireland's, you know, every year. We've won 5 at Ireland's in our history. You know, there's been 3 managers in the history of Galway that have won at Ireland's, and then when we get one that wins one in the most recent history, we let him go. You know, we let him go, and like that was a travesty, in my opinion. You know what I mean? Because what he had was, he had huge respect by the players, huge respect, and he had the great ability to manage everyone. You know what I mean? And then also be near like your friend / father figure, if you know what I mean, off the pitch, which was a great balance. There was you were afraid to cross him, you know what I mean? But you could always go to him if you're an issue. And then I just think that whoever comes in has to have that same trait again. In Galway, I think the clubs dominate. I think it's club first, county second, in my opinion. I've never, like, I'm 33, so really, me looking at it from the outside in, or inside out, should I say, I'm probably 15 years looking at it, and I've always seen that the clubs will dominate decision making first. So if that's club structure, if club fixtures, whatever it is, that's always going to be the way it is in Galway. I don't think everyone's on the same page, whether that be on board, player, management, club level. I've never seen it, you know what I mean? And like, that's what's so frustrating, because we have all the talent and ability in the world that if we just all got on the same page, everyone, clubs, board, players alike, and, you know, if we could, I suppose, help each other out. Now, that's a broader topic that I can get into some other day, but if we could just all help each other out, not be pulled in opposite ways like a tug of war, you know, we'll challenge everyone, no problem. But again, history shows we don't. That's why we're only 5 other ends.
It feels from the outside like you're in some kind of hurling purgatory where the sins of someone along the way were so grave that for whatever reason, the countless brilliant youth teams that come through, the minor teams that we would have watched in All-Ireland Final Day constantly as the precursor, and then the under-21 teams, and then the amazing club teams that come through, all this talent, and it's like, this guy's the next superstar, this guy's the next superstar, this guy's the next superstar, and for whatever reason, something happens and the team falls away, or maybe it is, maybe the conditioning is actually has always been an issue, I don't know, but I'm very interested to see, like, what you're saying, you kind of feel the same, that there's something lacking, some kind of central leadership has been incapable of bringing everybody together.
Listen to me, I'm not trying to say that, I'm saying that fully out straight to you. It's 100% a central system. Like, so I always say, if you're the managing director of a company, you know what I mean, whatever decisions or actions are done by your staff is the directive of the managing director. So it's his kind of, his direction, his vision, you know, his way of working is what everybody else kind of tries to employ. You know what I mean? And like, it's the same thing in hurling circles, and like, you're at board level. Whoever's the main dog, right? If he's implementing academy structures and good fixture plan, let's say, for clubs, and everybody's thriving, you know what I mean? It's a breeding ground for success. But you've got so many different fractions, and you've got this guy over this part, you know, and he's not really talking to this lad over here. And it's just, you know, it's so broken. Like, and there's no real collective thinking. It's very, very individualistic, I think, in Galway. You know, I was talking to my brother-in-law last night, and he was telling me that he's coaching rugby in the schools around kind of Loch Ray and around this area. And I was just thinking, geez, who's coaching hurling in our schools? Like, you know, and I was just thinking that there should be a fundamental plan put in at youth level, at the very, very basis, to capture youth. Yes, they're doing it in the clubs, but to capture kids who are anything from 8 up to 16, and to hold them and get them kind of obsessed with hurling like I was as a child, and to keep them going, because how many people are you going to be losing to different sports? Like, we have a couple of guys who are on a minor team now that are really good players from, like, Sabanaso, a club who wouldn't be dominant, and they're lost to rugby now. You know what I mean? Why couldn't we capture those, you know, either in an academy structure or something like that to keep them going? And I just think there's not collective thinking in Galway, and until we come on board and collectively think as one, we're not going to be able to challenge every single year. Like, we expect to win every year. I don't know why we expect to win every year, because we don't. We have 5 at Ireland's in 125 years. You know what I mean? So I don't know what, like, people think about that. A minor and an under 20, with the greatest respect now, and Gerard Nan used this phrase before, they're dancing medals in comparison to the senior at Ireland. You know what I mean? We all have, I'd say if you count up the minors and 20s in Galway, you'll hit a couple of thousand. You know what I mean? But you count up the seniors, you know, you won't get past 100. Do you know what I mean? So, like, that's the size of it. And it sounds like harsh talk, but it's real talk, Jerk. You know what I mean? And until we can fix that and get real structures in place from academy right up, from strength of position and skills, we're going to be always on the outside, I think.
So you talked about Micheál Donoghue there. If he was interested, the county board, it sounds like, should be going on bended knee to try and get him back?
Go down, with a bouquet of flowers, go to his door and say, come on, come back, please. Like, I personally speaking, even though I've no involvement with the team, I would love to see him back because I know how good he is. I know how well respected he is in management terms and how well got he is around amongst, you know, supporters and the way he's able to capture them, let's say, in 17 and 18. So even though we didn't win in 18, but he's a great manager. And I just think it's a bloody sin if we don't go about and getting the best manager possible for this group. And in my opinion, that's Miguel. Whether he'll do it or not with a young family, I'm not sure. Do you know what I mean? How his position is in his professional life, I don't know. But I think every effort, anyway, honestly, should be made to bring him back.
Okay, the other contenders who have been mentioned, Davy Fitz is obviously the standout name in terms of track record and fame. What would Davy Fitz managing Galway look like?
It's kind of an image, like, I suppose I've been forced to imagine it over the last 10 days, you know what I mean? But it just doesn't fit with Galway. You know, I think when he went to Wexford, I think the county as a whole were looking for a bit of rejuvenation. I think probably the team were looking for a level of professionalism and management that they might have seen before, and he brings those two things with him. You know, as I said earlier on in this, I don't think Galway are in need of rejuvenation. I think they're in need of a collective approach. That's why I went for somebody in-house who has the knowledge of basically everyone in the county. And, you know, I just think that they need to gain the respect. And there are certain ways, certain counties have certain, you know, principles and ethos. You know, I think Galway's kind of ethos, let's say, when you're in there, is kind of a real collective approach, a real kind of shared responsibility between management and players, how they're going to, you know, develop a game plan and develop a system and come together, find out the bad parts, you know, share their own thoughts, debate it, and then go in one direction. And I just think that's kind of not really in the David Fitz model, in my opinion. So that's why I'd be going for someone in-house to try and do that. Like, I don't think the Galway players would take, you know, dictatorship two-handed. You know what I mean? It's just the persona. Maybe something in the West. I know Anthony Daly wrote an article a couple of years ago saying that we were a strange bunch. You know what I mean? The Galway people were a strange bunch and he couldn't put his finger on us. Like, so maybe that's the part of playing a tool.
Was Dalo saying that in an admiring way or was it in a confounding way that actually...
It was actually at the time whereby Shane O'Neill hadn't been nominated and Micheál had stepped down with all the furore with the board and whatnot. And then there was that kind of purgatory period of whereby there was, you know, a few weeks, I don't know, maybe 5-6 weeks, I don't know, of where we were kind of searching for a manager and there was a collective approach between board representatives and players to try and find the best candidate. And that's when the article was released and he kind of was saying that, you know, I have the specifics wrong here, but he said that he was approached by an officer of the board, let's say, before Micheál had even stepped down, you know, which doesn't surprise me. And like, you know, that kind of, it was an odd bunch, there was no real collective thinking in Galway. Again, along similar lines to what I was saying a few minutes ago.
Yeah, and like, it sounds like you kind of agree with them in a way.
Yeah, and as I said to you, it's harsh and it might offend people. I don't want to offend anyone. Like when I'm talking about these people, I'm not aiming this personally at people. I am just saying it's a business, and that's the way you have to think of the county teams nowadays and boards at whole level. Like, it's a business that needs to be managed correctly. You know, so I'm not attacking someone's personal views or their personal life. What I'll be going after is their capabilities to manage something so large. Like, you're talking about a board now, a county that is operating in the millions in terms of turnover. Like, you know, so you're not just talking about some lad who you can pluck out of a sitting room and put him into a management role. You need someone who is strategic, who has a broad plan. You know what I mean? That's where you see all the terminology coming out of these counties now, for their, you know, their plans and their Limerick put in a plan years ago with their academy, and now people are scratching their head how they're so good.
Yeah.
Sure, geez, like, do you know what I mean? Like, they put their plans in place, you know, years ago, and now they're getting the fruition of those plans. And I would love to see that in Galway. I would love to see a concrete plan, a document developed that every club can follow, every person knows it's a uniform document, it's a central document that we could all, you know, strive towards. You know what I mean? And like, there's so many brains in Galway like that. There's great people in Galway that could do all this, whether they're in the business capacity or sporting capacity. And, you know, I would hate to see those lost to other areas, you know, or other counties even, you know.
Or other sports, as the examples you've given.
Yeah,
We're nearly out of time on this. Like, it doesn't sound like Micheál Donoghue is going to come back. Your instinct is that he probably is too busy at the moment, which will actually leave open the possibility of everything that you've said, that one of the easy fixes, the manager on the shelf, break glass in case of emergency, it might feel a bit like an emergency. Is it more or less likely that Davy Fitz, despite what you've said, will actually end up as the Galway manager?
Again, I find it hard to believe. I would strongly imagine that that the Galway players would be consulted, you know, on who would be at least consulted. I'm not saying they're going to be decision makers, but at least be consulted, because we, like Galway players, we've been involved in, you know, our own share of what people call controversies when you go back to the entity Cunningham thing. But they were proven right. You know what I mean? The Galway players back then were proven right. As much as people didn't like it, and maybe it's a generational thing too, Ger, whereby people beyond their 40s and 50s don't like, they call this player power. It's not. It's not player power. Like, in years previous, you could call it that. But nowadays, like, you're talking to very, very intelligent people who have a really strong opinion and who've lived this life, let's say, in terms of pain, and they can see, you know, that when standards aren't set at a very high level, they can call it out. So that's not really player power. You know what I mean? That's just a realization that the setup's not good enough. So when you go back to the whole anti-Cunningham situation, you know, it was extremely important that we came together as a group and we got changed. When we got changed, we got an Ireland. You know what I mean? So that's important nowadays too. So I think the players should be consulted. And I just don't think he fits the bill, if I'm honest. You know, and if the players themselves, if they decide collectively he does fit the bill, then I'll back them. I'll back them 100%, even though I'm not his greatest fan in the way he operates his business. Again, nothing personal against him. It's just the way he operates his own structure and management. But if the players back him, I'll back him. But again, I just can't see it. I just cannot see how we go to him. And again, financially speaking, his setups come with a, you know, with a price tag. And that's, even though it's not spoken about, not written about in correct ink or black ink, it's a reality. And we know it, and I know it, and you know it. That it'll come with a price tag, and it's coming a lot of effort to try and keep, you know, those people paid. That's the fact, yeah.
Okay, are there other people then who are obvious candidates apart from the ones that we've talked about, Michal and Davy Fitz? Is there somebody else that you're thinking, now's the time, it's your time right now to take this group and mould them over the next 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, well, like, there's wishful candidates and there's actual candidates, you know. Actual candidates, there's 5 or 6 of them, you know what I mean, you know, they get it, you know, that kind of way. Wishful candidates for me, and I know, like, and he shook me for this, because, like, he's one of my best friends, but there's a guy, Damien Joyce, player of Galway, like, and the minute you say his name, I guarantee every player in Galway will know it. Hugely respected, and he's got a great brain. But I do know, let's say, from a family perspective, from a work perspective, time might not suit. You know, that's my wishful. I would love to see him. I'd love to see Noel Larkin back in with Galway to see what he brings to it. I'd love to see the likes of Franny Ford. Cyril Donlan was a great mind, you know what I mean, for such a young age. He's only 35, 36, but he's got a great mind. And, you know what I mean? And those 3 or 4 guys collectively, I know you're bringing back members of the 17 team, you know what I mean? But again...
Well, it does strike me that's a very recent, successful All-Ireland winning side. And if you look around the country, the age profile of management teams are getting younger and younger and younger. And so why not? Why wouldn't your group decide it's our time now, it's now or never? Listen to Andy Moran on the football pod, and he's like, I'm 37 38, it's either now or never. I'm like, well, actually, you've got another 40 years there, Andy, where your brain is going to get bigger and bigger when it comes to tactics and stuff. But like, that chutzpah is right there for you guys now if you wanted to go and take it.
It is, like, you've got great brains, and that I just said Jamie Joyce because I know him the best out of the lot of them, you know. But there are those people across the clubs, there's numerous people across the clubs that just need to be enticed out, you know what I mean. I think there's a small bit of snobbery too in Galway about whereby, oh, they have to come to us to put their name forward. Do you know what I mean? Rather than we go get them. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I that's just, I don't know, I can't explain why that
it's,
is.
It's not just Galway, it's Irish life. It's Irish life. Like,
Or he has to come to us. He has to come to us. Like, we can never succumb and go to him. You know, whereas I'd be upfront, put your hand up and say, right, I want that guy. Do you know what I mean? Let's go get him. You know what I mean? So, like, again, you've got Jicey. You've got Cathal Murray doing well with the Camogie team. They're in the final on Sunday. Don't get me started on that now with the fixtures clashing with the Camogie, right? And, like, you've got really good people. Brian Henley did well with the Minors, you know. So you've got Dave Morris is a fantastic brain. He comes from a football background, but he's probably the best brain I have ever met in sporting terms. Do you know what I mean? And, like, these people are out there. Just go get them.
Okay. All right, it's a very interesting period of time where all of these jobs are up for grabs, and still we have Limerick over on that side. But Limerick did lose their strength and conditioning guy to Ulster Rugby, so maybe there's just a little chink of light for everybody else out there. Always great having you on. Thanks a million for joining us this morning, James. Cheers.
Okay, John.
It's always fascinating listening to James Cahill, who himself has a giant hurling brain. It's 18 minutes past 9 this morning here on OTB AM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Here's what we got coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. OTB Gold is Jack McCaffrey talking with Joe Malloy. That's an interview in between his two retirements, or maybe they're not retirements, but stepping away from the game. Mount Rushmore today, apt Tyrone. Will somebody else be getting up on the Mount Rushmore for Tyrone at the end of this week? Potentially. Our retro panel is GA meets basketball. I think that's Donaghy, McHale and Jao. I'm not sure, but it could well be. And it's absolutely brilliant stuff. And then Cora Staunton is OTB Gold from 6 in the show, obviously live from 7 tonight. We're going to be chatting with Ellen Keane next. She won a gold medal in Tokyo. We're going to hear from Leona Maguire. There's more from Owen's trip to Mayo. And we're back after these talking football.
OTB AM.
20 minutes past 9 this Thursday morning. Now, Allianz Ireland has been a proud sponsor of Paralympics Ireland since 2010 and has been a partner with Ellen Keane for the last 5 years. And I'm delighted to say Allianz Paralympic brand ambassador Ellen Keane is with us now. Ellen, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. I'm a little bit tired, but that's okay.
I saw some fairly spectacular scenes on the seafront in Clontarf last night where you were driving around and there were horns blaring and there were people out with tricolours. It was your official homecoming last night. Fairly sensational stuff to live through. What was it actually like to be in the middle of it?
Oh my God, it was madness. I was completely unexpecting it, to be honest. Like, I knew it was coming and I was aware that, like, people were messaging me saying they were going to come, but to see like complete strangers and hundreds of complete strangers just standing out there clapping, beeping horns, cheering me on, it was so lovely, especially having been in Tokyo where there was no crowds, there was no one in the stands. I didn't have that experience of getting on the podium. I could hear my teammates, but our team is so small that it didn't really have the same effect as yesterday. So when we were driving around as well, I got a bit emotional, I'm not gonna lie. I was at times I was like, am I crying? I don't know, but no, it was so special, so special.
Kelly Harrington had a great line about the last mile being pretty lonely when you're trying to achieve anything, and I'm sure it's been like that for you over the last while, in particular because of the COVID delay and everything that came with that in getting ready for the Paralympic Games. So on reflection, what has that whole weirdness been like for you?
It has been really, really neat, but at the same time, had so much support and up, and my friends have been backing me for so long, and they were still there even after the uncertainty. Kind of just that little bit, and it's all going to be okay. You never really felt that alone because everyone was kind of around hoping and wishing you well. I'm lucky enough as well because my boyfriend is he's college's coach from, and I've been going through this together as well. So he came home a little early and he was literally like, nobody understands. So now that I'm home and we're together, it's literally like we understand what's going on. And it is a really, really lonely kind of feeling when you come home as well. But because it was my fourth games, I was aware of it and I knew it was going to happen and I wasn't surprised by kind of the come down feeling. And I think that's something that maybe first time Olympians or Paralympians need to understand, need to know that it's okay to be feeling really, really low, because you have been training maybe your whole life, maybe just the past 5 years, but just for that moment to get there. And it's over so quickly as well. And then you kind of have to be like, where do I go from here? But I think it's just important. My plan now is just to relax and feel whatever I'm feeling. And I think that's just a really important thing to do.
That's knowledge, essentially, that you have acquired from post-Beijing and everywhere in between.
Yeah. And that's the thing as well. I think people, when they go to their first games, they have all these hopes and ambitions, and it's hard to actually get to a games and even get a personal best because it's all just so new and so big. And I know there are some people who didn't have performances that they wanted to have, but that's where like experience comes in. And now next time around, it mightn't be as difficult and you might be able to manage it a little bit more. And there's just no way of really, as much as you have support in the background, nobody really knows what it's like until you get there. And then that experience that you have, you bank that in your mind. So the next time you go, you'll be a little bit more prepared mentally.
Does an event like last night, where there is an outpouring, that like a physical outpouring, a manifestation of people's love for you, does that help with the come down, or is it actually kind of almost more pronounced?
I don't know how to answer that. I guess it was just so emotional for me yesterday because, like, I knew how much this medal meant to me because, like, I've been it's my life that I've been living. It's my fourth games and the fourth time that I went, and I finally got that gold. But I didn't realize how much it actually meant to the people of Clontarf. And I saw it yesterday, so it just made me so proud to be able to do that. And, like, in the back of my mind, I think I had such like a mental block for a long time, and I have overcome that, and now the possibilities are endless for me. So my mind is now going to Paris, and my mind is like, what can I achieve in Paris now? And I think that kind of helps as well with come down as well, knowing that I want to do it again and knowing that there is more, and I just need to figure out and make a plan of how to get more out of myself.
That was pretty quick, because was there at some point in your life a doubt about whether or not Tokyo was going to happen for you? Where had you wavered in the past and said, okay, I've had my experience about this, I'm going to go off and do whatever it is that I'm going to do after my sports career? Like,
not so much that Tokyo wasn't going to happen. It was more that I was in a rut, and I think any sports person can relate to this, that when you've been at something for so long, you kind of get to a point where you might improve for a very, very long time. And I think that's something that maybe younger people coming into the sport need to realize, that you're getting loads of personal bests, you're improving all the time, but then you'll get to the point where it's not going to improve anymore. And you need to figure out mentally how to get the next percentage out of you. And I think I was just stuck for a very long time because mentally I had so many races where I was just swimming the exact same time in and around 122, 123. And I knew that I was capable of swimming faster. And for Tokyo, it was kind of like, if I can't do this in Tokyo, then I'll probably retire. And I did think about that. I did think, like, I'm not going to spend years of my life training and getting stronger and feeling faster and not actually improving when it counts, and it not showing that I've been training hard. So when I actually got to Tokyo, like, I knew medals, I was aware that medals were there. But for me, it was like, I just want to go and do the job, get the job done, show people how fast I am. And I think that confidence going into Tokyo really, really helped. And I kind of blocked out all the silliness of all the frills that come with the games. And I kind of just wanted to get the job done. And even the few days beforehand, when we had been tapering down and resting loads, people kept asking me, oh, are you nervous? Are you excited? And I was like, I'm just bored. Like, I just want to get in and do what I know I'm capable of doing. So in the heat, when I went to 121, yeah, I got a PB. I was content with that first morning swim. It's always harder to swim fast in the morning. So I was happy with the morning swim, but I was like, I know I can go 119. And I knew that despite racing Sophie, even like a few days before the race, when I saw the entries and I saw Sophie, I literally was like, oh, I'm so afraid, because she is a nine-time gold medalist. This was going to be her chance to try and get a 10th gold medal. And I was possibly the one who was going to get in the way. And I knew how close the race was as well. For the final, I just was so confident that I had done everything that I possibly could do. And I just felt so prepared. And I think if you go to a games knowing that you have left no stone unturned, then whatever happens, happens. And that's literally the last thing that I told myself before I walked out was, no matter what happens, I'll be okay.
did you know months out that you were in that form and that you were on that trajectory, or did that realization come pretty close, even kind of on the morning when you do the PB? You're like, okay, everything that I told myself was true, or did you know it had been true on the basis of everything you had done in preparation?
I think I knew it was true for a long time, and that's why I didn't want to go to the European Championships in May as well, because I didn't want other people to know. And I kind of wanted to keep it to myself, and I kind of thought that if other people knew, then I might start to feel the pressure a bit more. I might start to have the self-doubts, but like my team knew, my coach knew, even like some of my athletes were like, I've never seen you like so in the zone and so ready and prepared. And like that, hearing that from your fellow teammates, it gives you so much confidence. And it's a lovely thing to hear that they also see it and they also feel it. So having that environment and being in that environment definitely helped in Tokyo, just to kind of keep cool and not panic. And I think that's kind of what I've done in the past, is I've nearly heard what people expect of me and I've been too afraid to do it, because I don't know, maybe it was a fear of failure, or I could just feel the pressure and I didn't know how to deal with the pressure. But even like the lead up to the 100 breaststroke, I just came off social media. I just didn't want any outside influence because I was so confident in what I could do. I think just the confidence leading in and knowing that I was in the shape for a very, very long time was really reassuring.
So what changed from a psychological perspective to give you the freedom to do that?
Honestly, I think it was, I know how like the pandemic and not being able to race and train was really difficult for me, but I think the time away from racing and away from expectation and away from my own want to swim a certain time, I just kind of gave myself a break that I never had before. I was constantly racing, constantly competing. And since I was 13, so that was like 12 years of just constantly going and constantly expecting to swim a certain time and not doing it. So to have that time off and to have that step away from racing, it kind of gave me a bit of perspective to realize that it's just a pool. You just need to dive in and get from one point to the other as quickly as you can. Whatever is going on in the background doesn't matter. Just focus on what you can control. And I think there was a lot of things in the background as well that I couldn't control, but I was focusing on those things and I just decided to forget about it. And I think that's a lesson going forward now that I have definitely learned from Tokyo, that just the control the controllables. And I know lots of people say that, and I've said that before in the past, but now I really, really know what that means. And even at nighttime, like I'd go to bed, I'd text everyone being at like 9 o'clock saying I'm coming off my phone. I'd turn off my phone and then I would just chill out for an hour and then I'd go to sleep. And it was just those little things that I was doing and I was in control of. And they were also giving me confidence, knowing that I'm going to have a great sleep now because I've come off my phone and I've done all this.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's really all the little things right. I knew I was doing all the little things right. So on the day of the race, I was like, there's nothing more for me to do, just do it.
Every half-assed coach of every team in the world says control the controllables, but actually I'm not sure they live it or they know what it means. Or, you know, it's great to have these aphorisms that you spit out at people, but having lived that high performance life and having been through the experience that you have over the last 12 years, it's a fairly amazing skill set and bank of experience that you've built up. I know you're obviously interested in a career in the media, but have you thought about a career in high performance after Paris as well? Because it seems like that journey that you've been on is, it's not unique, but it's certainly your ability to communicate it the way you've just communicated it this morning. You could inject that into, we had James Scahill on talking about Galway hurling. You could inject it into any inter-county setup. You could inject it into any individual. Like, is this part of your life that you're ready to impart that wisdom with other people?
Yeah, like I think I'm gone.
We still got you.
Oh, it literally jumped. I do really, really enjoy it. I do really enjoy the high performance environment and the lifestyle. But I think for a long time as well, I kind of knew what I kind of knew what it was, but I had never lived it. So anytime I did a talk or people wanted to hear about my swimming, like, I would always talk more about like my experience as a person with a disability rather than my sport, because I kind of felt like I hadn't nailed it yet and I hadn't understood it yet. So I'm not going to stand up and talk about what other people should be doing when I haven't gotten there yet. And now that I've finally gotten there, I almost feel like there was no other way for it to end. And now that I've finally gotten there, I am excited to share my story. I am excited to maybe make a difference to people. So yeah, I do. I really would maybe perhaps go down that road, but I'm not finished yet. There's still so much more in me. And now that I've nailed it and I know what I'm capable of when I really, really focus, I'm quite excited for Paris to see what I'm capable of there.
Yeah, it's going to be an amazing, like, and the fact that it's coming around so quick in Olympic cycle. I mean, 3 years is still 3 years, but it is actually pretty quick. One of the best things that, that we always get thrown at us is when we're talking about stuff, and particularly if it's football or if it's whatever, the show us your medals texts come in pretty quick. And the old pundits who did play the game, if you've ever got an opinion that they disagree with, they're like, oh, show us your medal. You now will be able to show everybody your medal. Can you show us your medal today? You've got it with you, I think.
I do. It is.
That's pretty sweet.
It's pretty sweet, and it's also really, really heavy. And it's really shiny. Like, I don't think the medals from Rio were this shiny, or maybe just because it's new. It is a very special medal. And I honestly, even in Tokyo itself, like, I hadn't really reacted and I hadn't really realized what I did. And I think I had been talking to one of the Kiwi boys, and obviously he would have been a teammate of Sophie. And it was him saying, I don't think you realize what you've done. And I was like, what do you mean? I don't think you realize what you've done. And he was like, nobody beat Sophie. Very few people beat Sophie, and you beat Sophie. And I was like, oh, that was kind of when it kind of sunk in. And then even on the podium, hearing that I was the Paralympic champion, it wasn't even the gold medal, it was the Paralympic champion that kind of got me going. And the difference I think that this medal is going to make in terms of growing the profile of Paralympics even more in Ireland, like Clontarf put up that. So the logo for the Paralympics is called the Agitos, the symbol. Not a lot of people would confuse it with the Olympic rings. So even they could say Paralympics, but they'll put the Olympic rings up. And in Clontarf, they put a flag up of the Agitos. And that got me going as well, because I was like, that's for me, like, that I'm doing that. And I'm just so proud that I am able to do that and maybe inspire a few kids along the way to get involved in parasport.
Yeah, look, I think that's definitely part of it. I don't know if you saw the cover of the Irish Times where it might have been Kelly Harrington, it might have been you, it might have been Leona, and it might have been Katie Taylor about how the women are taking over. And that's the other aspect of this, is that, like, we've had 12 to 18 months on the back of the 20 by 20 campaign where the women have taken over and they've achieved unbelievable things. And every single one of them in their own way are breaking down barriers and setting new trends and inspiring people. And I don't know, it is an absolutely sensational moment to be a young woman who is interested in sport and going, well, what am I going to do? Look at all these amazing role models I have. I don't know if you felt any of that, or if you feel part of that, or if it's in any way an inspiration to you. But you're definitely inspiring.
It's funny because I think knowing those girls and like seeing them train and seeing them compete, it's almost like I almost feel like we've just had enough of being called women in sport. Like, we are athletes, and even I've had enough of being called a disabled athlete. Like, I am an athlete, and that's one thing that I really noticed in Tokyo as well. Like, the Olympic and Paralympic logos were side by side all the time, and we were just treated parallel to the Olympians. We weren't treated any differently, and it was just, we are athletes here to compete, and that's what us as women are doing. We're not talking about being women in sport. We're talking about, we are high performance athletes, and we're going to show you what we can do.
I think that comes through loud and clear from all of you as individuals. And I think it is definitely a moment for us as a country. There's been an awakening over the last number of years. I think the Meath footballers helped that. I know probably as a Dubs fan you weren't too impressed by that, but hey, look, it's good for the game, it's good for all of us. Ellen, congratulations, it's a remarkable achievement, and we're really looking forward to what happens over the next 3 years as well.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the support, guys.
It's Ellen Keane there, Paralympian gold medalist, and what a shiny gold medal it is. Of course, a brand ambassador for Allianz, who Allianz Ireland have been a proud sponsor of Paralympics Ireland since 2010, and I've been a partner with Ellen for the last 5 years as well. Right, we're a little bit late, so we went a bit longer than that, but definitely worthwhile. It's 9:40. From one homecoming to another, after her sensational Solheim Cup performance at the weekend, the people of Cavan put on a brilliant homecoming for Leona Maguire yesterday afternoon. Aisling O'Reilly was there for Off the Ball and caught up with Leona.
Leona, how are you feeling? Unbelievable scenes here in Cavan, probably scenes that you haven't ever seen in Cavan before.
No, I mean, it's absolutely incredible to come back to all this. Wasn't expecting this at all. Only a few hours ago I was in Ohio, and then to see everybody else out with the flags and jerseys and all the smiling faces, it's great to have people out and giving something to cheer about.
And as we've seen you come in, you know, there was a fire truck in front of you, the guards were there, you were hanging out at the back of a BMW. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, these moments don't happen very often, so might as well enjoy it while they do. And I've had the support of this incredible community for a long time now, and it's nice to share this moment with all of them. And probably a lot of people watch golf here that wouldn't normally watch golf, and it's nice to have them enjoy it as well and have something to root for. I suppose Cavan didn't get too well in football this year, so it's nice to give them something to cheer about. The lads carried us last year, so it's nice to do my bit this year.
That's what your dad said. I was speaking to him and he said, you know, the lads did it last year, you know, when COVID and everything was going on, and Leona's just doing it this year. And as we're standing here in the Sleeve Russell, like, this is where it all started for you. You know, 10 years of age or maybe 9 years of age, you went out with your clubs for the first time. Is it mad to be standing here now and to see what you've achieved?
Yeah, it's definitely a bit surreal. I suppose I've spent more hours out here than I probably have at home, practicing, pretending there was different shots to win a Solheim Cup or win an LPGA event or whatever it is. So, yeah, it's nice to have everybody here, all the ladies in the club here and family and friends and people I haven't seen for a while. So to get them here where it all started and get to share in the experience is pretty good.
And also with Lisa as well, I spoke to her and just about being alongside you the whole time, you know, especially when you're at the Solheim Cup, you know, she was with you that whole way. How important was it, I suppose, to have her there?
Yeah, I mean, Lisa's been a massive part of everything. There's no way I'd be where I am without Lisa, and she was a big part of our team this week. We didn't have a lot of support out there. She was one of the helpers with Team Europe this week, and the whole backroom team was incredible, and Lisa was there walking the fairways with me, radioing in my scores, doing everything I needed. So she makes my life pretty easy.
And just speaking on the support, you know, the noise from the crowd was something else, and as you said, it probably wasn't support for Europe. So did you feel that pressure at all? Like, it looked like you had nerves of steel.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was surprised by how comfortable I actually felt. Obviously, there was big, massive USA chants and cheering, and but we knew that's what it was going to be. There was a bit of heckling going on Monday and stuff as well. So it's like nothing I've experienced before, having people clap when you miss a shot and stuff like that. But tried to embrace as much as we could and really just soak it all in. And yeah, had an absolute ball.
And 4.5 out of 5 points, you know, hey, that's just incredible. You know, nearly a flawless performance. Can you just describe what it means to have played the way you did?
Yeah, I mean, never could I have imagined that the week would have gone the way it did. I'd have been happy enough to play 2-3 matches. Never did I think I'd play 5 and to be the only person that played 5. And that confidence that Beanie and the captains had in me was incredible and really humbling as well, and just wanted to do everything I could for the team. And I had two fantastic partners in Mel and Georgia as well, so it was very much a team effort. We were in the right place at the right time, and yeah, thankfully we hold a few putts right when we needed, and Mel hit that clutch shot on 18 as well on Sunday, which was massive as well to give us momentum into the last day.
What's next now for Leona?
Home for a week and a half or so, and then back out to the States for 3 events, and then we'll sort of see what happens with the Asian swing if that goes ahead, and then finish off the year in Florida. So still some golf to be played yet, and hopefully can carry this momentum through for the rest of the year.
And how do you enjoy all this side of things? My last question for you, you know, seeing all these fans, supporters, the kids looking for autographs. I met one little girl who said she's just started playing golf and she wanted to come and meet you today, and she was a bit emotional coming up meeting you. I seen her, you know, it's really nice to see that side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was the thing growing up. There was no Irish golfers on the LPGA. We'd no Irish golfers on the Solheim Cup. And hopefully after this week, there'll be some girls and little boys wanted to get out on the golf course and get golf clubs and whatever it is. And even if it's not golf, if it's any sport, I think that's been the fantastic thing over the last even couple of months with everything went on, Tokyo at the Olympics and Paralympics and all of that. You can really see the power of sport, and hopefully it's inspired a young generation of new Irish athletes.
Yeah, it undoubtedly has. It's like, this is a golden age for Irish sport, and we should really revel in the fact that there's a global superstar, so humble, back where it all started with her sister and her dad playing for Crunchies, as he told us in the show on Tuesday morning. Fairly sensational stuff there. Fairly sensational stuff in Clontarf last night, where there's a homecoming for Ellen Keane as well. And then obviously in Portland Row earlier this year, when there was a homecoming for Kelly Harrington too. So remarkable time for Irish sport, and we shouldn't lose sight of that this weekend. Obviously the Camogie on Sunday. Interesting stuff there from James Gale, talking about the fixtures being scheduled at the same time as it. So we still haven't quite nailed getting everybody out to support their own teams at the moment when they need their support the most, but we'll get there. We'd love to hear from you, obviously. 085 087 9180 180 is the WhatsApp number if you want to get in touch with us. A reminder, OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. If you missed anything on the show this morning, subscribe to the OTBAM podcast feed. You got the full thing there, and you also get the show broken down in bits in our other streams, OTB Football, OTB GA, whatever it is. Tomorrow morning, we're live from Tyrone. Owen will be in Omagh as we bring you another special show building up to the All-Ireland final for 2021. Not finished yet in Mayo, though. Here's Owen, Mike Finnerty of Sky Sports and the Mayo News talking about the build-up to the All-Ireland final in Mayo. Enjoy.
We are here in Westport at Mayo News HQ with the man himself, Mike Finnerty. Mike, how are you getting on?
Owen, how are you? You're welcome to Westport.
Thanks very much. It's a lovely setup you have here, and an unbelievable issue, I think it's fair to say, this week. I might just show everybody at home the front of the main section there. That is Enda Hessian's cousins posing beside an up Mayo photo with Enda's face superimposed on the car itself. This seems to be a real theme across Mayo, just turning every single car green and red.
Yeah, it's one of those photographs that it looks posed or it looks computer generated, but having been there at Roundford National School last week, I can tell you it's 100% authentic. And you know, sometimes you have an idea in your head and it doesn't quite work out. Well, when I went to Roundford National School last week, everything fell into place. They had three of Enda Hessian's cousins all togged out and ready to go for a photograph. As you say, a car painted green and red with Enda's face on the bonnet, and hundreds of locals and kids lined up to talk to as well. So Bula bus for Roundford National School.
Absolutely, it's great. Great for the photographers going out to all these schools to get something like that. As you can probably see on the front then, and you might just hold that up for the camera there, Mike, is the front page of your mega supplement, I think it's fair to say. So talk us through the front of this.
Yeah, this was an idea that two or three of us worked on together, started a couple of weeks ago. And I suppose credit where credit's due, the germ of the idea came from listening to the Paddy and Andy podcast on Off the Ball, when Andy just happened to use that phrase, opportunity knocks, for the two teams. And I suppose it did spark an idea in my head. I sent a rambling, long-winded voice note to Jen Murphy, our very, very talented illustrator, who has worked on all our Mayo covers over the course of the championship. And the end result is this creation, where we've got the three Mayo footballers that we felt you would want to have with you if you wanted to kick down heaven's door to get your hands on the Sam Maguire, namely Lee Keegan, Aidan O'Shea and Padraig O'Hara, with Cathal McShane and Tiernan McCann from Tyrone hovering in the background, looking to get their crack at it as well. We've got a fantastic reaction to it. It's become a theme of our coverage over the course of the season, these illustrations on our cover. And look, the payoff is when people react the way they do, and kids get a kick out of it, and big kids get a kick out of it. And yeah, I think we're on to a winner there, all right.
It's one to keep for sure. I just jotted down one of the lines from the interview you did with Andy, actually, inside. And the idea of opportunity is a big one. He talks about the opportunity of a lifetime, but he also mentions the lifetime of the opportunity, which I thought was a very good point. And this really is one of possibly the peak of the opportunity that this team, or that these teams in the past have had.
Yeah, and it's a theme actually that pops up in a few different articles throughout the supplement, and it does definitely speak to this sense of a lot of people feel this is 50-50, and it's a wonderful opportunity for either Mayo or Tyrone to win this breakthrough All-Ireland and to break, obviously, the dominance of Dublin. And in Mayo's case, you know, nobody needs reminding, it's 70 years. And you could, like, I had a fascinating chat with Andy last week, and you could just feel the energy, as you always do, coming across the table. He knows, like, this is so close and yet so far away for Mayo. And it does feel different to other finals. Obviously, it's the first final against Tyrone. They're so evenly matched. There's so little between them on paper. And, you know, from a journalist point of view, when Andy did use that line when I spoke to him last week, and you know it's tied into the cover as well, you do get that sort of a buzz as well, where you're thinking, we're on to something here. You know, we've hit the right note, because, you know, you don't want to be the paper or the journalist that reads the mood the wrong way and maybe pitches it too high or too low. But I think what we've tried to do as well, and you probably got a sense of it travelling around Mayo yesterday and again today, we're trying to capture the mood. And despite what maybe some people outside the county might think, you know, about hype or Mayo losing the run of themselves, there's a completely different mood around this year. It's much more understated or low key. Yes, there's lots of colour. Yes, kids in particular are throwing themselves into it. But I think people are so worried, first and foremost, about getting a ticket. And then they're so worried about getting carried away and getting disappointed again, that it is this whole idea that it's a wonderful opportunity, and now we just need to go and take it.
It's really interesting trying to sum up that mood, isn't it? Because, like, you know a lot better than I would in terms of how it differs to other years. I can only speak for this year, and it seems, I don't know, are the people of Mayo almost taking on the mood of Pádraig Ó'Hara, where it's okay to enjoy these moments? It's okay to not get carried away, but to ride the crest of emotion on All-Ireland Week. It feels that Mayo people are really enjoying this, rather than being terrified of the prospect of losing in All-Ireland.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, a couple of my friends, and we were speaking about this at the weekend, like, we're at a stage of our life now as well where, like, this is my 8th All-Ireland final to work on here at the Mayo News as sports editor. I went to the All-Ireland final with my dad in 1989. I can remember it so clearly. Like, we've been through it all over the years. You know, people of a certain age, like Sean Rice, who writes for us, Sean is in his mid-80s. Like, he remembers 51. And he's still waiting for the next one to come along. Like, you've got this huge cross section. I was talking to kids and teenagers in the last week or two for the supplement. They don't really remember Mayo losing too many games, you know, particularly big games at Croke Park, with the exception of those All Ireland finals against Dublin. You know, they've been brought up and dined out on Mayo successes. Then you've got somebody like the former Mayo footballer Billy Fitzpatrick, who we spoke to in the supplement this week, came on against Dublin at the age of 41 in 85. You know, he's a legend of Mayo football. Like, Billy would feel that, you know, the 70s, you know, nearly haunt him. He played with Mayo back then. Mayo didn't win a Connacht Championship between 69 and 81. You know, so you've got all these different experiences and all these different genres and age profiles of Mayo supporters who all want the same thing now, but have lived through completely different experiences. And as you said, the mood is definitely, I think Pádraig Ó'Hara set the tone. And he obviously didn't know he was doing that at the time. But that interview was so powerful and so honest and so raw that it did strike a chord with Mayo people everywhere. And I think it nearly knocked them into shape or brought them into line or something ahead of the final to go, he's right, you know, let's be level headed about this, but let's not doubt ourselves either. And that's, in my experience following Mayo teams, that's always been a difficult balance for supporters maybe and players as well to strike, and journalists as well over the years. Because when I think back to 96, 97 and even 04, 06, like, we surfed the wave, there's no doubt about it. They were good times, you know. We, of course, had the boom as well in the mid-noughties, so we were all high as kites. But I think COVID as well, I think you can't underestimate the impact COVID has had, obviously, on everyone's lives. People want a little bit of joy now as well. They want to try and, you know, enjoy the build-up and enjoy the experience, but it'll only obviously count for anything if Mayo can win on Saturday.
One of my favourite pieces in the supplement is Colin Sheridan writing about the prospect of winning the All-Ireland, and there's a very good piece in it where he wonders if actually getting to the promised land is a little bit like Brooks in the Shawshank coming out of prison and realising this ain't what it was all cracked up to be.
Yeah, Colin's a genius, by his own admission, a tortured genius. Yeah, it's a beautiful piece, and there's no doubt about it. Every time Colin writes for us, you know, it's maybe 2-3 days later, you're driving along some isolated boring somewhere to some game or something, and you just start to ponder the meaning of life. I don't know, he's got this ability to play with your emotions and to really ask these questions that only start to sink in days later. But he's a beautiful writer. And yeah, I'll be honest again, Colin's a little bit younger than me, but it is something that would have cropped up in conversations that I would have been in late at night, maybe after big defeats or maybe a league win or something, you know, where you do start to think, I wonder after all the years of chasing this elusive kind of holy grail, I wonder what it will be like or what it would be like. And when we do turn around, let's say Mayo win on Saturday, and as Pádraig O'Hara says, that's the plan. You know, when we turn around next January and we hit into the FBD League or the National League or whatever, I mean, what will that feel like? I've no idea. But as soon as you even start to ponder that, you immediately know, you can feel yourself being pulled back and saying, well, hold on a second now. We're getting ahead of ourselves here. Because I do think, I actually, the phrase I used there at one stage was, I do think we've been brainwashed in a good way by James Horan down here over the last number of years. And Stephen Rochford would have been the same. And Pat Holmes and Noel Kennelly would have been the same, where this constant message that comes out of the camp that, you know, we take it one game at a time. It's all about the process. James Horan, I remember him saying in an interview at one stage, you know, he hates to hear these phrases about quests and journeys, you know, doesn't like that kind of loose talk. Like, let's talk in real terms here, you know, let's talk in tangibles and things we can measure. And I suppose we've all started again to take note of that as time goes on, that, you know, it's possible to enjoy the games and enjoy the build up, but keep our feet on the ground. And of course, you're going to meet super fans. You've met a few already along the way, and you need those as well. You know, they're important as well. But I think generally speaking, there's a much more level-headed approach, and that comes from the top down, in my experience, yeah.
It does seem to me that when you're doing a big preview of an All-Ireland, you start to discover new things. Are you still learning things every time you put together a supplement?
Yeah, very much so. And yeah, it shouldn't be like that, really, when you think about it. But for example, Edwin McGrail went to enormous lengths to write a profile piece on Lee Keegan this week. It actually covers, runs across 3 pages, the 4 ages of Lee Keegan. And it literally charts his journey from a teenager who was trying to make it with the Irish youth rugby squad to heading into the All-Ireland final next weekend again. I couldn't believe what I was reading and hearing, you know, going through that piece. Edwin spoke to some of his coaches from secondary school, spoke to Kieran Shannon, who worked with Mayo as a sports psychologist back in 12 and 13. Pádraig O'Hara profile that Michael Gallagher, another one of my colleagues here, wrote. Pádraig O'Hara is a fascinating guy. Really interesting to hear from former teammates, former coaches about what makes him tick and how he's come so far so quickly. And then, of course, if you go back to the 1951 stuff from Sean Rice and Daniel Carey, I always find that so interesting. I mean, when you consider, this did genuinely take me by surprise, that when Mayo won the All-Ireland in 1951, it didn't feature on the front page of the Mayo News. That sort of blew my mind. Mm-hmm. I would love to have been at the editorial meeting on the Wednesday or the Thursday when somebody was been called to task for that particular call. I think the subject of dancing and ballroom dancing was quite topical at that stage in Mayo and across the west of Ireland, and there was a big story, and it bumped Mayo's All-Ireland win, I think, onto page 2 or 3.
Incredible. So what's going to bump Mayo off the front page next week?
Unless there's an earthquake or an outbreak of, I don't know,
the some Virgin sort. Mary appears at Knock for the second time, potentially.
Exactly, yeah. An apparition at Knock, I'd say, could definitely lead to some tense conversations here around our cover. But I think if Mayo win the All-Ireland at the weekend, I'm pretty confident a photograph of the Sam Maguire Cup in some capacity will feature on the front, yeah.
There's two things that I learned. Two things that I want to mention that I learned. There's tons of things that I learned. First of all, Mayo's original version of Niall Morgan, Mick the Kick.
Oh, what a story. And there is a story behind how that appeared in the Mayo News. And I know Kevin McStay won't mind me telling it. Kevin wrote a column for us for many years, up until 2014, the end of the 2014 season, when he moved on to bigger and better things. He's now with the Irish Times, of course. And Kevin rang here on Monday morning. We were close to deadline to say that he had researched and written a piece for the Irish Times this week that wasn't going to make the cut. It had just ran over the word count, but he felt it was something that could add value to our preview. And lo and behold, he delivers 350 words of pure gold about his former teammate, Mick the Kick Higgins, who legendary footballer here in Westport and played for Mayo, who Kevin wanted to set the record straight in case anybody thought that Niall Morgan had kicked the longest ever free in a championship game. It turns out that Mick the Kick scored an even longer one in the 1975 drawn Connacht final between Mayo and Sligo up at Markovich Park. And I think the quote from Mick, going from memory, she was around 90 yards. And as anybody who knows Mick Higgins will tell you, he's never too far wrong. So, yeah, great, great yarn. And one of the ones that really, as a journalist, gives you a great kick when you see it dropping, yeah.
Yeah, so Niall Morgan in second place. We need to clarify after Mick the Kick. And then the second thing is your own breakdown of the backroom team, like which is really interesting. And one role that really stuck out to me was Ger Cafferkey, values and behaviours coach. Because it's very, like, James Horne has obviously come back a new man and has hugely deserving of all the credit he's getting. But I'm sure having a values and behaviours coach who knows what he's doing in Ger Cafferkey probably helps the process as well.
Oh, very much so. Funny enough, that backroom team profile is a piece I do before all the finals, you know, going back to maybe 12 or 13, and obviously updated and freshen it up as management's change and backroom teams change. But it's very popular because the way it's gone now, people don't really know for sure who's involved or how they're involved or what their roles are. It's just the way the setups run now, inter-county setups, it's quite tight. And some people you see on match day and others you don't. But getting Ger Cafferkey involved is a very shrewd move. I'd have interviewed Ger a number of times. He's a previous Club Stars Award winner, our annual club awards night. And he's a fascinating guy when you get to spend a bit of time in his company. And immediately when I saw that he was involved, what that would suggest to me is that James needed to fast track the development of the young players he brought in. He needed to fast track their development in terms of learning good habits and being trained in the ways of your Andy Morans, your Shamie O'Shea's, your Tom Parsons, those guys maybe who had stepped away in the last year or two. So Ger Cafferkey, I would imagine, is spending a lot of time with the likes of your Enda Hessian, Oisin Mullen, Owen McLaughlin, guys like that, Tommy Conroy, who've come in over the last few years, and making sure that they're aware of how it works inside the setup, how they're expected to obviously, you know, carry themselves, conduct themselves, stuff they're supposed to do away from the training ground. And I know as well he would work with them quite a lot on, say, post-game stuff in terms of going through their performances. Like Ger is developed quite the reputation for being extremely hard on himself when he played for Ballina and for Mayo. I think Ger had a list, a diary that he would keep, and he would rate himself and mark himself on various different aspects of his performance. And even before matches, I always used to be amazed. Ger, when the team would arrive, Ger would head down to each goal mouth where he would be playing full back or cornerback or whatever, and he would go through some visualization techniques and routines. That was part and parcel of his prep. So I've no doubt that comes into it as well. Certainly when that role appeared in the All-Ireland final programme back in December, that was the first time there was a title put on it. Right. It certainly raised a few eyebrows. I think probably a few people in certain quarters might have been looking down their nose a bit at it, saying it sounds a bit pretentious or it sounds a bit maybe unnecessary. But you know, the more time goes on and you see Mayo's results and you see how quickly the young players are developing, you start to think, yeah, there's method to the madness. And yeah, Ger Cafferkey is a very, very capable guy, former All-Star, huge experience. And I think if you're a young player getting advice from him, you're listening, you know.
Yeah, it's a really interesting breakdown of everyone who's working with James. Anything else you want to mention before we wrap up?
Yeah, I suppose the one piece that I was proud of myself in terms of how it came together, I decided to do a profile on James, just again to try and bring people up to speed on James Horan 2021. And again, my chat with Andy Moran proved invaluable there. And the two things that jumped out at me, and they were connected, they were part of the same answer. When I asked Andy what did he think James's greatest attribute as a manager was, No hesitation, didn't blink, didn't flinch. Confidence. He said it's the confidence he instills in you as a player. And then he went on to say that the only other manager he'd ever played under, or the only other manager he'd been in a dressing room with that came close to James when he really goes to work in terms of building you up for a game or for a second half was John Mahon at his peak. Mm-hmm. And I would never have compared James and John. I would never have thought that they were similar managers, similar coaches. They're very different personalities. But that gave me a great insight into what James must be like in a dressing room on match day. And I think a lot of people would have taken an insight from that. It's not all
him. There's also another nugget from his book in that piece I should have mentioned, yes, as well, which is a good one about Cork in 2011.
That's right. Yeah. No. And Andy's book is going to be a great read, and so, yeah, he's well able to plug it himself. But I think you know it's the least I can do as well. I'm looking forward to it. Colin Sheridan working with him on that book. I was just going to say as well, it's not all heavy analysis though, and hard work or you know in depth reading about the game. We also went for the lighter side, and there's some really funny bits of crack pieces in there. And I think two that I would pick out is we wrote a fictional WhatsApp exchange between some members of the Mayo squad that might give people a bit of a laugh, and also Ger Flanagan, one of our most valued stringers, now a former full-time member of staff. He went off and sourced a little bit of background on some of the younger players in terms of what makes them tick. Are they big into social media, cars they drive, you know, what they're most likely to say and all of that. And again, it just gives people maybe a little bit more of an idea about what Tommy Conroy, the footballer, is like, or Enda Hessian, the footballer, is like. Because again, we just maybe get to see them in these little bite-sized post-match interviews where people are wondering what are they really like. So, there's something for everyone, I suppose, is the best way to put it, yeah.
Without question. Finally then, Mike, I can't let you go without asking you for a prediction for Saturday evening.
Yeah, it's become a real cliche now at this stage, and I was listening to second captains actually yesterday, Oisin McConville and Paul Flynn, previewing the game, and I found myself very much agreeing with them. It's actually so close in most people's minds that the smallest thing you read or hear or think about, you know, tips you one way or the other. Now, there are exceptions. I've met some people in the last couple of days who are convinced, absolutely, utterly, totally convinced that Mayo are going to win this and not win it well, but you know they're unwavering in their conviction. But I just think when you've been down the road the way we are as journalists and you know you've come in here on Monday mornings bright and early after all Ireland finals and you've literally had to pick through the wreckage to bring out supplements. You know it's once bitten twice shy. You are hesitant about really nailing your colours to the mast. And I think it's going to be very close. I think it's going to come down to the smallest thing. And again, to go back to Andy, I thought it was a very astute observation. The team that does the right things the most will win the game. And it sounds so simple, but like you consider the 2-1 goals for Mayo and all the misfortune and mishaps and bits and pieces. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it went to extra time. I think it's that close. But there's something telling me at the back of my mind, yeah, that Mayo will find a way. They'll find a way. The strength and conditioning is so good. Obviously, if Oisin Mullen is fit to play, that's a big boost if he can play any part at all. I think we could end up with a scoreline similar to like the 1992 or 93 final. I think we could end up with one of these really low-scoring games. But I think they might just find a way, but we might have to go through the ringer. We might even have to come back the following Sunday.
I think going through the ringer is the only certainty from this Saturday, Mike. Yeah. Mike Finnerty of the Mayo News and, of course, of Sky Sports, thanks a million for taking us through the supplement this morning.
You're welcome, Mo. Thanks very much.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.